All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
First they said, all right, when you land in the UK, you've got to get a PCR. So that was all right. You can just get one at the airport, like you said, Bissett. But now they're saying, oh, you've got to get an antigen before you leave as well. So I booked that for tomorrow. Needed to buy a Barca shirt for Connor's kid. So I did that today. I need to get a haircut and the beard sorted. That was supposed to be today, but there was loads of people in the barbers.
Fucking everyone's having barber issues at the moment. You know what I mean? All the lads.
Yeah. Yeah, big beard there, Jim.
No, it's not a beard. Stitch it up. I've got no beard issues.
There it is.
Hey, right, buddy. Good to see you, man. Hey, congratulations. You're gonna be a dad, or are you a dad already? What's the story?
Gonna be, man.
That's fucking wicked, man. When's the kid coming?
May the 15th, apparently, man.
May the 15th.
Could be any time.
Oh, that's wicked, man. Really glad for you.
It's safe, man. Thanks.
Who's the lady?
Just a woman that I met at work. And then... Just happened, man. quite quick, but it just happened, man. So.
Good on you, man. Good on you.
Yeah, man. The time is right, man.
I tried to get this Barca shirt today. So I look up on my phone, where's the nearest Barca shop? Because there's a few. There's one just down the road from mine. I was like, fucking sweet. I'll run down there before the podcast. I get down to the street and I can't see it. I just see like the little souvenir shops that you get here where you can buy fake Barca shirts. And I was like, oh, I ain't got time now. Fuck it, I'll buy him a replica. I go in, buy a little replica. And as soon as I come out, next door is the real Barca shop, isn't it?
Well, you saved yourself €45. So
saved loads, yeah. The replica was 20 and the proper one's like 70 or something.
I kind of feel no, it's going to be screwed.
Yeah, he'll know.
I called him after. I was like, oh, God, tell you. But he was all right with it.
He was fuming, mate. Gary,
kicking off.
How's his nipper now?
One and a half now.
That's mine. The kids aren't gonna take the piss out of him in sport, are they? Like, they're not gonna be like, you're the fruit.
Mm-hmm. And he'll grow out of it in a week anyway.
Yeah,
and it won't fit him in a week.
Yeah, so when he's older, I'll get him a proper one. Yeah, exactly. You know, he'll get some mileage.
Never kids stop growing. Right, talk about sport.
Why not?
Well, it's a sports podcast. I mean, we do want to do the political podcast. It's got to come into effect one day.
You'll be talking about galaxies and that in no time, man. Supernovas and all that, man. He scares the shit out of me, Big Stevie does, every time I talk to him.
As you can hear, we've got a fourth voice on the podcast today. It's our good friend Stevie, big Villa fan.
Big Stevie Stitch.
Little Stevie.
Yeah. Welcome to the show, Stevie.
Big up, lads. Long time listener. Top podcast on my Spotify this year.
First time participant and caller.
Overdue.
Oh yeah, long time ago.
Yeah.
And I think your participation is particularly timely, given that Gerrard is absolutely smashing it at Villa. I want to hear about this, man. I want to hear about the shot.
It's a good time, man, at the moment to be a Villa fan. Well, in the last how long has he been there for? Well, 2 months.
Month, isn't it? Month, yeah, month, yeah. Not very long at all, is it?
Honeymoon period.
Yeah, it's a honeymoon period, but.
Flynn's gonna proper dig into you with the facts on the honeymoon period later. And yeah, I've got facts. Doing the research. Good lad.
Little facts.
I've got facts for you. I've been tracking it, and I'm going to continue to keep tracking it
in real time. Flynn's tracking the stats in real time.
When he said that, I'm going to continue to track it as well.
And I will.
the film's like when they've got that like that dodgy screen, they're like, I need to tap into the mainframe database.
Yeah.
That's how he looked to me.
When he's buying the pizza delivery van, like absolutely tracking everything, opening doors and that.
Oh, I've watched it way too much The Wire, man.
Shit, they're onto us. We got to go.
we'll crack up the preamble ramble though, because it's going to be a bit of, I want to say a long one. And I'm probably not going to get all through this, but we need to talk about it, man. Honestly, we need to talk about it. What happened with Hammond? I know you've done a bit of research into it as well, Finn. But we'll just give a little bit of a context before we sort of dive into the nitty-gritty. So, and I know you're kind of up on your Formula One stuff as well.
Yeah. I'm a long-time F1 fan as well.
So there you go. So
through my dad, he's always watched it. So I'm not like... you know, I'm not like I need to watch every race, but I'm if it's on, I'll watch it, you know, and I watch it, I definitely watch it.
Good. So you'll be able to maybe corroborate some of the stuff that I might be chatting, because I was doing that. I was like furiously ranting all this down like on Tuesday, but it was kind of after watching it, really. I was sort of like absolutely hanging out my ass in a Manchester pub, and I was asking this kid, I was like, what's going on? Because everybody was like looking at this. Everyone was like staring at the screen. I knew it was on, and I knew there was a big sort of rivalry between Verstappen and Hamilton sort of like going on all season. And I was just watching this, and I was like, what's going on here, mate? Because it was like during that sort of, I think, lap 52, was it, or 53, when the safety car came in?
Yeah.
And he was explaining it to me.
Wasn't it?
So like, to put it into context, obviously, whoever won this would take the Drivers' Championship, innit?
So
I mean, as I said, like, I'm basically going to paraphrase a lot of this anyway. So prior to the race, so we'll talk about it in sort of like the full context of the race. So what happened in the 21st lap with Red Bull's teammate Perez? Did you see?
So
he was in
first position, and he effectively slowed up Hamilton, like just blocking him off, so Verstappen could catch up. Then let Verstappen go past him, so he could carry on racing for it. So he was used as like a decoy to stop him. Yeah.
So and I was reading,
which was quite. It was quite interesting to see that, because obviously there was nothing to play for Red Bull other than for Verstappen to win the championship. So
yeah, because the Constructors' Championship has already been going to Mercedes. Yeah. So I'm so glad you're here and then you clued about it. That's because it makes it so much easier than me having to read like four pages of me writing
and
stuff.
And also based off the man in the pub, the most credible source. Which is more than I'm the bringing to the table. So I'm not fussing with it at all.
But this geezer was saying that he's some of the best defensive driving like he'd ever seen. Do you know what I mean? And it is pure shit-out tactics, and we can get behind that, man. We're always into stuff.
I'm all for it, man.
It's a bit like Mourinho, like fucking, you know, parking the bus. That's it. It's kind of like that, but in Formula One.
But if you've got a teammate that's got no chance of winning, you may as well utilize him to that extent, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, especially when it's like ineffective that like if he wins, it doesn't matter. You know, so he's not going to try and win it, is he? You know, he's not going to try and pull forward and do whatever, you know, to ruin his own team's chance, because they might have even had a rivalry earlier on in the season when they're all going for it, but when it comes down to the last two drivers, it's like he's got to do everything to help his teammate, hasn't he? But they were also saying before the race that Bottas might have messed up Hamilton, his own teammate, because Mercedes have dropped him for next year.
So they were saying they never knew
whether that was going to come into play, but obviously it didn't in the end. Yeah,
politics.
He wasn't happy because he obviously wanted to stay at Mercedes. So they've had big rivalry on their own team for years. So.
Added another intrigue to the matter, but obviously that didn't end up. The whole defensive driving thing didn't really matter, did it?
Nah.
But by the 53rd lap, when Nicholas Latifi, who was basically out of the race when he was like eons away from everybody else, he crashed with five laps. Is that right? Five laps with the race to go.
I'm not too sure on the exact one, but yeah, it was right near the end. That's when the safety car was out for like three laps.
Then basically the safety car comes in and that slows all the cars down. And the race director, who in this case was Michael Masi, like he's in charge of like basically what happens after that point. So what did he do that everybody is so like upset about?
Well, he's gone back off his own word. He said that
the cars could lapped
cars weren't allowed to overtake each other, but then he let that happen in the end, which then caused it let Verstappen go for the one-on-one race with Hamilton.
So it created a one versus one horse race.
That's what it was at the end.
And they're saying it's like they're all kicking off about it, but they're saying that he's got the right to do whatever he wants, and that the team agreed to that before the race had even happened. So Red Bull gambled by bringing Verstappen into the pits to change his tyres. That was a big gamble.
Yeah.
That wasn't necessarily going to pay off. Hamilton could have done the same thing. He could have gone in, changed his tyres, and he could have come out behind Verstappen and effectively had a one-on-one race himself from behind Verstappen. And he might have won himself then, but they didn't want to risk that, you know. So everyone's moaning about new tires and stuff, but it's, that's the way it is. It was a gamble for them. Yeah, still, it was, they didn't know, you know.
That's what they were saying on the commentary. They said, like, basically they're neck and neck now, Verstappen on the fresher tires, and straight, knowing as little as I do, literally my F1 experience is watching the Ayrton Senna documentary and watching Lewis Hamilton about 10 years ago. But I know that tires make a massive difference, especially that late in the race. Well, that last lap was like absolute drama. Wasn't it, man? It was unreal.
That's what you want to see, isn't it? Like, you don't. That's kind of why I'm not. I like F1, but it's kind of why I'm not gripped to it. Is because not every week you're going to see a race. You're going to see either Hamilton or Verstappen winning a race by however many seconds, and no one. It's not a competition, you know. No. It's usually like the middle of the pack little battles that are better in a race, but because it is so unfair these days with the two main teams, you know, that are just. I've got more money and whatever. It's all money controlled, you know. So it's hard, man, to get in. That's why people are buzzing about it necessarily, because they've created a spectacle at the end, you know, for like Formula One.
So it was like, straight. You was down to the wire. Exactly, like
straight shootout, wasn't it? Yeah, definitely.
That's what you want to see. That's like what you want to see, though, isn't it?
Angus was in the kitchen. I called him in and says, "You need to get in," and he didn't come in. I was like, "You need, like, come on, man! It's like the last lap." And you come in and it was like, you know, it was a mad way to end it.
I think, yeah, it created history in the fact that the race director created this spectacle and created this, like, kind of one-off opportunity that, this, to be honest, I don't think that's ever going to repeat again. Yeah, happened, is it?
Well, it's happened in Italy as well before, in this season. Hamilton benefited from his own, so, like, the opposite way around. So it happened, the safety car came out and Hamilton beat Verstappen. From that same like scenario happening, but earlier on in the season, so it's not really looked at as in it was like the decider, so it's magic.
It's not completely out of the realms of possibility. It might be why Hamilton wasn't complaining too much.
And there was a few questionable things throughout the season that have been.
I'd heard that. Yeah,
you know that Hamilton's got away with, and so is Verstappen. So it's you know what I mean, it's a dog eat dog.
Yeah, for sure.
It's
man.
Like. They'll just go for it, man.
And it's in their best interest to make the sport as entertaining as possible. Bear in mind, like,
put it on the map, you know.
And like, mm-hmm. It's already a well-established sport. It's got a lot of lilies, a lot of history, a lot of grand moments. But those races are really long, and as you alluded to, Stitch, when they're dragging on for hours, and literally
it's
the guy
20 seconds ahead.
The guy in first place is going to stay in first place. There's no tension. There's no drama. There's
just... Yeah, but you're taking the integrity away from the sport. You might as well not call it sport. You might as well call it fucking WWE or something.
Which I love, like, so I'm all for.
Call it something. You can't call that pure sport.
Not really, though, because it's money fueled, same as how football's gone now. You know,
yeah, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. It's not whoever's the better driver, whoever's. Wherein it's down to whoever's got the better car now.
There's a lot of factors going into. We've spoke about this before, about loads of different aspects of sport.
Look how much money they've got, you know.
No, sporting integrity.
Competition prior to the actual starting of the match or the fight or the race, whatever it is fine. You can pump in as much publicity and money and as much, like, generate as much like money from the way you do business as you want. But when it comes down to the actual nitty gritty and you're in that moment in the sport, in those 90 minutes, in wherever it takes, hour and a half, like, you can't have somebody that's going to, like, manipulate it like the race director did. And I think he made decisions not based on the sporting integrity, but he made decisions based on the fact that he wanted to generate excitement in it.
Well, he had two choices to make, and whatever choice he did make would have made the winner. He could have chose to not let any cars unlap themselves, and then Hamilton would have probably won, though we can't say either way.
He was 11 seconds ahead, though, wasn't he?
He was 11 seconds ahead, so he probably would have run.
Stop a crash, can you? You know, you can't stop a crash. That's life.
The decision he's getting a lot of flack for is basically, so you've got the safety car out. You've got cars that have become lapped, yeah? And now you can either choose to let them unlap themselves or not, and that is the race director's. It's at their discretion. What he chose to do, which was a bit unusual, he only chose to let five cars unlap themselves, and they're the ones that were between Hamilton and Verstappen. Yeah. Now, he's allowed to make that call, even though that is an unusual call to make. He should have either let all of them unlap, which would be the ones behind Verstappen too, or none. And it looked like he was going to choose none. That would have been the safer thing to do, because if he'd let none, they wouldn't have been able to finish a complete final lap properly. They'd have to wait to do this whole lap. The safety car goes away. Then they can do this half lap, which he didn't want. And they'd all agreed beforehand. There's like a general agreement between teams to not finish behind the safety car. So he made a call. And man, I imagine there's a lot of pressure in that position. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of money running, a lot of pressure. And he made a call to make it more exciting.
Yeah, what, which is better for
but
us.
What also is the what another topic is that the team chiefs had direct contact with him on radio. Mm-hmm. So that was like,
which shouldn't be allowed.
Everyone's saying really? That's weird.
It's
saying,
like the manager's having a conversation with the ref.
Yeah, exactly. So it's weird.
Well, they do. They can shout to him, but then, like in his ear, like
it's then, a shady move.
But like Flynn was saying, if the safety car stayed out, there would have been uproar from that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We'd let it finish with the safety car, you know, because that's not what people wanted to see.
If it's within Massey's discretion to make whatever decision he wants, then we can't really complain because they've made the rules themselves. That was long-standing. But I think if we focus on the final lap itself, I mean,
it was exciting.
You don't often see like Lewis Hamilton get done over in those situations there.
And you're even thinking, mm-hmm. really. I'm even thinking as Verstappen's taken him, he could even still crash out because he's, imagine how much adrenaline's going through that body when he's like, he's overtaking him. He's probably thinking, I still got to go mad. And he's like, he could have definitely done like
a lot of composure.
Anything could have happened, wheel blowouts, anything.
Oh, in that final lap, I've had an issue with that at all. Yeah. I just had an issue with the way it was handled. And I mean, if I was going to do the rules for that, I would say that like after the safety car, but like, whatever intervals they had between each other. So if Hamilton had a 12 second interval over whoever's in second, you'd reset it.
No, but that's not how it goes. It's never been
too many factors.
That's the beauty of it in a way, is that a crash can effectively bring anyone back into the game. You know what I mean? Like it's one of those.
It's an unpredictable mm-hmm. facet of a largely predictable sport.
It's a good point, yeah.
But I was comparing it to like a football team being like 3-0 up in the 90th minute.
I hate all these comparisons.
And then there'd be like a big injury on the pitch, and then like referee Bozo or something goes like, you know what, next game wins. Next goal wins, man. Yeah, next goal wins, that's like one. That.
Next got classic headers as well.
But it's not going to end anytime soon anyway, because Mercedes are taking, or they can't take it to the arbitration of sport.
He's withdrew all his offers, all his complaints, hasn't he?
They got disputed. Mercedes did a couple of appeals, citing certain articles in the rule book. And the FIA have dismissed them all by quoting other articles that overwrite them. So they're like, Article 6.7 says that you can't do this about the unlapping. They're like, well, Article 12, which we wrote, says we can, so fuck you.
Mental gymnastics, classic. Like.
But I find it funny that they can't take anything to the Court of Arbitration of Sport. Like, they have to go through the FIA. So it's like they have to explain to the people that made the mistake like the reasoning why they were wrong. It's just like they're not just going to agree with that, are they? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know, man. To me, F1's always seemed like a bit of a closed house in terms of what the rules seem like. And again, basing this on
it changes every year as well. So it's like, you know, it's such a hard sport to keep up with.
Same with the NFL, man, and the way they change the rules, man. They made like 12, 13 rules a year.
Same as
the
NBA does it as well. Yeah. Don't they?
Well, also, same as the Premier League. Last weekend, with those penalty decisions, the same.
Do you remember, like, was it last season when they were all those handballs? And then just like halfway through the season, they're just like, right. We're not going to give them anymore. Loads of teams have been done over by, like, the ones where they were just hitting them on the side and they were
Was getting ridiculous, wasn't it? When I walked in this evening, you guys were looking at a penalty decision between Man City and Wolves from last weekend, and instantly we disagreed on it. Yeah. So let's just go through, may as well, innit?
Yeah, I think there was seven penalties in total.
I've done some notes about it, man.
I think seven penalties in total. I want to say the probably
for me,
what the worst one was probably the Leicester one, the James Maddison trip by Jamal Escales. Like, in my opinion, James Maddison has deliberately sort of leaned into Lascelles, and Lascelles tried to pull out the challenge and he's gone over. And even after video assistant refereeing, which is meant to essentially like get rid of the sort of like, you know, conspicuous decisions and like sort of like make sure the referee knows. I feel like now it's got to a point where referees are just making decisions and on the field. And if it goes against them, it never will go against them because they don't want to overturn it, like his opinion. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I feel like it's becoming a bit more to what we had before.
From me going to the Villa most weekends, the vibe we get now is every time he goes to the screen, he's going to change the decision. So if it wasn't a penalty, he's going to go and look and he's going to come back.
That's mad.
That's what
if he goes to the screen.
Yeah. You know what I mean? That's the vibe. Now you're kind of, if you see him running over to the screen, you think you're done for. You. Or if it's you're thinking we're going to get the penalty, you know what I mean?
But what's the impetus on the referee to even look at the screen? Do you know what I mean? Like,
they're looking at it and they're saying that it's that they don't know.
You need to take a look at
this. Come have a look at this. But as you said earlier, and again, I don't watch as much football as you guys, it seems to me that if they make the decision and they make it like, and they look like they're quite certain with it, then nothing happens regardless.
So I'll go to the Wolves game.
Yes.
Let's go across. The Moutinho one, for me, seeing it first glance in play, I thought it was a penalty because his arm was seeing slow action replays and it looks like it hit his armpit. I was kind of thinking maybe I've changed my mind. I don't think it is a penalty. But then VAR have looked at it. They've given it. No, did they give it on VAR? They did, didn't they?
Which one?
Is it the Moutinho?
They had to review it.
Yeah.
I think he already gave it, didn't he? The first time round, did he give it the first time round?
Did he go and look at
that? And then they must... Well, we looked at it as spectators for the TV, but I don't know if they looked at it.
Yeah.
But they were saying a definitive angle from VAR. So how... Like, I don't understand how we've got this technology and we don't have definitive angles for them to make decisions.
But they did, though, like, from what you said, the armpit, I'd say it looked like it hit him like up here and then kind of hit underneath of his arm.
Well, I was listening to it live on the radio that day and they kind of said, well, we don't think it's a penalty, but they said it's bounced off and then onto his arm. So they're kind of saying that's like a grey area because I don't know whether they're saying it's meant to be, if it hits another part, then hits your arm, it doesn't count as a penalty or whatever.
If his arm was in a quote unquote natural position, whatever the fuck that means, I'm basically saying that means like in a running motion or Flynn's throwing some mad ballet shape right now. That's pretty what I'm thinking. Moutinho's arm was raised, his elbow was up, his hand was up. And that's what indicated to me that it probably should have been a penalty. That was your thing.
I agree with you. I agree with it. He did have his arm on the way down. I think he was trying to get his arm out of the way. And that brings a whole another factor into it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what is the exact rule on this? And as you say, like, all the rules are changing constantly. So,
and then VAR can't even tell you what's happening because they haven't got a definitive angle.
And that's what the whole thing's there for. I mean, it's absolutely on point when it comes to goal line technology.
Yeah.
But still, when it comes to fouls, when it comes to handballs, and again, because they've revised the rule so much, I think in the beginning it was too precise and it was stopping games too often and it was interfering with the flow of play. So they've decided to kind of bring it back a little bit. But now, as you said, we're kind of in the same. You may as well not have it if we're going to do this.
Exactly. It seems to create more problems than the ones it initially set out to solve.
Back to the one that you said as well with the James Maddison, and that got reviewed and given. Like that's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
Seeing that one even in slow motion is ridiculous. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
Oh, my God. It's so
good. Get up.
He doesn't complain. LaSalle doesn't complain because he is in the wrong. He stuck his leg out. So... Yeah. As soon as you stick your leg out, you're in danger of giving a penalty. Madison's effectively in the air before the leg's even out, you know.
All right, let's have a look at it now. Leicester players closing down the Newcastle box.
In real Madison time, it looks
like, that looks like a penalty.
In real time.
And where in the video is this?
This is 50
seconds.
Within the first minute, that is a blatant dive. That is blatant.
Obviously, the first time we watch it, we're watching on a screen and we're at how far away from the action. Referee's right on top of it. And then when you watch it in slow motion, you can clearly see Madison is initiating the contact.
LaSalle's has got his leg out, so it is.
Yeah, it's
attackers are going to use that opportunity, aren't they?
But you know, the referee is catching up with the action a little bit there. He arrives on the scene, but I don't know how close he is to it. If you pull that back up,
even the way he falls, that's what I've never got about the dives. That they never look natural, do they?
Look at the referee now. You can see him in the Harvey shirt now. There, he's quite far away from that.
All right, fine. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt. He wasn't on the scene quick enough. And he's got this beautiful technology that we've developed for this game, for these exact situations called VAR. He goes to the screen and he still gives the wrong decision.
Yeah.
That's
so they reviewed that.
They reviewed that and they said that's not for a penalty for me.
Nah, that's ridiculous, man.
So what's the criteria then?
Exactly. I don't think the VAR even know. Like, what is the criteria for why it's a penalty?
Yeah, so that was a trip. They're saying the leg was out. He's hit his knee.
There's contact, but Madison's deliberately initiating the contact.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
But LaSalle, does he look, not once does he...
It's like you say, he knows he's made a mistake. He knows he stuck his leg out rashly. He knows himself, and he knows there's a possibility of that being given, which...
That's just bad. It's cynical, that's, isn't it, man?
Bad. It's like James, James Harden does with the old, him getting the fouls. Yeah, he initiates contact as well, like a fish, just like...
Well, you know, you can't be mad at Madison. You know, everyone's playing to win. I don't really hate against...
All right, so there's three huge penalty decisions in the Chelsea versus Leeds game. So if you want to get that up as well, Flynn.
Yeah.
I would say by watching these ones, two of them were penalties, the first two. So one going to Leeds, one going to Chelsea. And then the third one, I think, was worse than that one we just watched.
I'm saying Alonso can't be going down that easy in the box.
Yeah, I agree.
It's so early. You can't be lunging.
That's a good tackle.
No, from one angle, it looks like he won the ball second angle.
You can't be lunging to the floor that early in the game with, you know.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, you want that to happen.
The guy we love to hate.
This one is, I think, correct decision. I don't know why he got VAR.
Let's have a look now. It looks like he's clattered him there.
Yeah. I don't know why he got VAR today.
Once again. Why on earth is he going to ground there? He doesn't need to go to ground there.
Why is the attacker in the box tackling the defender?
That's a question for another day.
Yeah, but you know, if you stand off players of this quality, then they're going to work something out. You've got to do something.
Don't go to ground, man. Yeah, try and give him a bit of space. Just you know,
the same Rudiger's fired up though, any man. So he's up there. You know, he's a decision.
And one team you do not want to concede penalties against is Chelsea, because obviously they've got Jorginho, who's one of the best penalty takers in the world.
Look at Rudiger.
Leeds are unfortunate now, aren't they? To be fair, they got absolutely walloped by City. They put up a good show up here.
They're missing good players.
And here you go, here's the last one.
That's a penalty, man. It's a blatant penalty.
Let's have a look.
It's such a lazy challenge. Like, I would be fuming if that was my defender.
Well, I don't see what's happening.
That's a Tyrone Mings classic, that is.
I don't know.
The back of his foot.
There's not enough time.
The back of his foot, man.
Can you pull it up, please?
I don't know about that.
I'm not convinced by that.
I just think it's lazy, man. It's just pure lazy.
Yeah. I think, Stitch, what you're saying is there are certain principles that defenders should abide by.
He doesn't need to be swiping his foot there. It's pure laziness, man.
Well, say if he takes a good touch there.
Look. That's a rubbish read. But this one, look man, he didn't get the ball. He kicked the back of his foot.
I don't think there was any more contact there than there was against James Maddison. Nah, the only difference being their body positions.
Nah, he's kicked the back of his foot, man. That's going to take you up, that is.
And he's got his back to goal as well. That's a whole other factor too.
So he doesn't need to be swiping his foot like that. It's a lazy challenge.
I think he's trying to get round him, hasn't he? He's trying to get round him and win the ball, but at the same time. Was it Rudiger?
Yeah.
Involved in everything.
Yeah,
at the same time, he's got... What's Rudiger doing?
He was going forward the whole game.
What are his options there, though? What are his options in terms of your man's got his back to go?
He's not going to go anywhere, so you don't need... He doesn't need to swipe like that. He could have just pressured him up, you know.
But what if he plays a central pass, then a midfielder's arriving late, and then there's problems? He's got to do something. Mm. What if he turns to the byline and then smashes it across the 6-yard box? He's got.
I think it's a foul, to be honest. I think it's... I think that's a blatant.
I think that's.
I'd agree completely. I can only see it from one angle, but it just looks like he kicked his leg.
Maybe I went a bit far comparing it to the James Maddison one, but it still seems a bit soft to me, man.
I still feel we're getting into the realm where, like, defenders are going to feel like they can't make any challenges in the box. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? They can't do anything. They can't make a challenge when the player's got the back to goal. They definitely can't go to ground because if there's any touch, I don't know.
You've got to look at that one, man. If that's my defender, I'm fuming because he's standing up. Mm-hmm. He's just swiping his foot. There's no need. He could just hold the pressure on him. He doesn't need to be doing that.
He's got to do something, though.
But he doesn't need to be doing that. Yeah. If you're a defensive-minded player, you're going to try and stand him up there. He's a centre-back.
Yeah.
You're not going to be thinking, this is Lukaku in the box. He's gonna score a screamer. It's Rudiger, you know. Like, you're not gonna.
That's a different. I hadn't really considered that. There's a difference between a world class striker with his back to goal and
if you see Jordan Henderson on the edge of the box, you're not gonna rush the closing down. Yeah. You're not gonna think he's gonna put it top bins. You know.
No, that's fair enough. And again, this is all happening in the moment, second by second, high pressure situation. I can't really blame the kid for making a mistake.
That level of information.
What about the Mings on Salah? Classic Mings.
Yeah, he's clumsy though, isn't he? He's a clumsy defender.
He was playing really well the game as well. It was just a straight, you know, just Salah's just too much sometimes, isn't he? You know, and
all the time.
Well, yeah, all the time, exactly. But it was just like kind of he didn't need to do it himself, but then you're thinking, is Salah then? He's probably going to score from any angle that he wants.
You know, Stevie's in Segway City, man. He's only first time on the rail. He's already
round of applause for Stevie.
He's a natural man.
Segway.
I mean, I've been big up Tyrone Mings a lot in the last few weeks. Do you know what I mean? I've never really particularly thought he was a great defender. I always thought he was a bit overrated. I didn't think he was really worthy of the England places.
I'm up and down with him, man. But yeah, over the last few weeks, he's really. But saying that, you have to the starting 11 of Villa. There's no one that I can't knock at the moment with the way they're playing. So he's the captain. So he's probably getting a bit more praise, but. And because he's been underperforming, so he's brought his levels back, you know. But,
so what particularly in terms of like the way Gerrard's setting Villa up to play tactically, what has he changed that's made him a better team?
Well, I heard that he's got a strict training regime, which they always say when new managers come in, don't they? Oh, he's got a strict training regime. But I think that's a factor. He's got Matty Target off the catcher.
Yeah. I don't even know what that means.
It's all that sugar, mate. It's all that sugar. Come on. That's what I'm doing. It's the only thing that's keeping me going. I think the way that we seem to be playing is, you know, when like someone gets a defensive manager or say like a legend striker, they're always like, oh, the strikers are on fire or the centre backs know what they're doing. Like when we had John Terry. But I feel like the midfield under Gerrard has become so much more dynamic, and I think that's a big part of the game. If you can control the middle, obviously against teams like City and Liverpool, you're not going to get a chance.
Yeah, you're fine to lose.
When I went to that game, Man City Villa, like the way they moved the ball is just like we didn't have the ball for the first 15 minutes. They just move it so fast and so swiftly. Like, but when you play against like
Norwich
and stuff, you see how it goes. You know, when our players are actually better than theirs, not going up against like a Man City or whatever. Teams that we should be hammering, like Norwich, we like ran them off the park, really, because that middle just seems like there's so much more there at the moment. Mm-hmm. Whereas under Dean Smith, I liked him, but it was just getting a bit now. What tactic has he got? Play it down the wing to Watkins, and it just wasn't working. And it was every Villa fan was fuming about it, and they didn't want to get on his back, but they knew it wasn't working, you know. And then now he's playing this like passing direct football through the middle. It's so effective with that middle, like just more present, you know.
I mean, Dean Smith obviously did like great things for Villa, but there comes a time where stuff, as you've just alluded to, plateaus, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Then obviously we've criticised Premier League clubs in the past for getting rid of managers too quickly, but at least in the honeymoon period, it seems like they've made the change at the right time. And I think those midfield players. They're gonna. How could you not look up to Gerrard, man? Come on, look at
Nakamba. So many Villa fans are on his back, and now he's voted for Player of the Month. He's he's getting starts regular under Gerrard. Like he's become such a different player under Gerrard, you know.
And obviously, he hasn't changed. He hasn't become a better footballer overnight since Gerrard's been there. Must be a really psychological thing. Yeah, that he's instilling confidence. Thing, yeah. He's giving players chances to improve. Like, for example, Jacob Ramsey.
He
seems to look a better player under Gerrard than he did under Dean Smith.
The first thing Gerrard's come in and said is that I see talent in Ramsey. I think how buzzing he's going to be, you know, saying if he's going, I think me and McAllister think Ramsey's going to be a top talent. Like, you're going to be buzzing at that.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to let him down at all.
Like,
you know?
And he gets that little bit of freedom, even when he's bringing on the other kids, like Chukwuemeka last night. And he got an assist and he's only 18, you know. And it's like, I was thinking earlier to myself, Gerrard, he got that chance when he was 18. He got that chance when he was young. So he knows what it's like to kids to think they're ready for it, you know. And he'll be like, all right, then there's your chance. Prove it, you know.
And he's done
and
it,
doing it, you know.
And he's done it at the very highest level. He's been part of some of those dramatic footballing moments I can ever watch. And so when he tells you something and you're a midfield player, whether you're 18, whether you're 25, whether you're 30, you're going to believe him and you're going to want to impress him and you're going to want to say, look, I belong in this team.
And he's probably thinking the same about when McAllister's like telling him things. He's thinking, I was playing as a kid when McAllister was playing and he's like a legend, you know what I mean? So he's probably thinking he's learning as well from the elders as well as he's teaching all the Villa players. But from hearing him talk, he's just very calm and collective. He knows how to come across well. he says like he wants to be the players' friends, but he'll also give them a shouting if he needs to, you know. So whereas I thought Dean Smith probably is that like nice sort of like dad vibe, you know, like he's going to get, I could never see Dean Smith being the guy that's going to shout at you. And if he did, you probably weren't going to be that bothered because he was a nice guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, if Dean Smith's the dad, think he's like the older brother.
Yeah, yeah, whereas Gerard will flip his lid, you know what I mean? Yeah. But he'll also probably be your best mate as well, you know, so I think he's fighting in that balance with some of the players.
I mean, it shows you what a dynamic can do, like a different dynamic and a different like breath of fresh air really to a club can do. And obviously, Flynn, you've been doing a bit of research into the whole sort of like honeymoon period that we were sort of like discussing over the last few weeks.
Yeah, that's right. For anyone who was listening a couple of weeks ago when we had Tino as a guest star, I quoted an academic study done by Dr. Sue Bridgewater of Warwick Business School. So in this study, Dr. Bridgewater, she collected all the stats from Premier League teams who had changed manager from 92 until 2008. She found that teams with new managers usually see an increase of points per game for about 6 to 12 games. Then between games 12 and 18, the points per game average drops back down and it usually falls below where it was with the previous manager. So with that in mind, I've started tracking, like I said earlier, points per goal average from the start of this season to see if her theory stands up. So far this season, just Premier League games, Dean Smith's had 11 games. He got 10 points. So that's an average of 0.9 points per game.
Yeah, yeah.
Gerard, he's had 6 games and he's got 12 points. So that's an average of 2 points per game. Now, so far, it's following the theory, but what she reckons and what she's observed in past seasons is that he's got about 6 more games at most of continuing this trend. And we might see a drop unless he's one of those unicorns who takes the club higher and higher.
It's good. It's interesting to have some stats that to put towards those old school football sayings. Like it's something that you just become accustomed to, the fact that all our managers in a new period at a club, like they generally do see success once they come in. So it's interesting to see there's some actual research.
As a team, you never want to play a team that's just got a new manager, do you? Yeah, because you know they could be bottom of the table and they're going to be, you know, just because they've got that injection from a new life. But it's a hard one, isn't it? You know, like...
Perfect time of the year for Villa, coming up to Christmas. How many teams, like, how much does the table in general change over Christmas? Mm. The fixture list is so packed.
Especially with all these COVID postponements now as well.
Ah, yeah, I didn't even think about
even
that.
Even another game tonight got postponed. So it's like, we're on 17 games, Tottenham on 14.
So just getting that gap that we had over that first pandemic season where there was like teams that were sort of five
and then
games
is it going to become again where you're playing Tuesday, Saturday, you know? Mm. Because remember, that's what it was like in the pandemic.
That takes a toll on Villa as well, because they've got a very young squad. And then obviously he's starting to introduce a lot more of the players from the U23s. So
yeah.
Interesting to see. I think Villa are going to have to spend in January and I think they're going to give him money.
Yeah, I think they will. There's
and he
no
might
reason
have a bit of pull as well, do you know what I mean? He might be able to bring in players and perhaps Dean Smith wouldn't have been asked for.
I think he will. I think he'll be able to attract some talent because he is respected, you know, like he's highly respected in the world of football, where some people won't know that Dean Smith was a player. You know, they'll just be like, "Oh, who is he?" Like, you know what I mean? But
well, from a physical perspective, that might serve Villa well, having a younger squad. But from a psychological and experience perspective, it might completely throw him in the toilet.
And in the Premier League, that's like they're the moments that matter. And having the experience in the moment is very, very important.
Well, you see it with teams at the moment and missing players, it takes its toll, doesn't it? You know,
Leeds especially. We'll have a quick word on Leeds because I completely forgot about that.
Segways.
You know what I mean? they've really dropped off this season, haven't they?
Especially after last night's result.
Yeah, they got absolutely. I mean, I'll say this to be fair to Leeds. It looked like everything that City hit towards their goal, there was deflections, there was like double saves off the keeper, and then Stones smashed one into the roof of the net. De Bruyne was firing on all cylinders. It looked like City were on complete top form and all the luck was with them. And then Leeds were just struggling to chase the ball.
Yeah, well, I thought they were going to get battered. I said to my dad before that he was going to be... I thought Leeds were out of form and City were in form, so I didn't think it made good reading for Leeds before the game, especially missing Calvin Phillips till
massive after
February.
Patrick Bamford's out. Pascal Stroik, yeah. Another important player for him. So Liam Cooper's out as well. So basically, their whole spine's out at the minute. It's very difficult for him. And I think, but I mean, has anything changed in you know, philosophically in terms of, because they was, when they first came into the league, they were like, oh, we're going to high press, we're going to choke everybody.
But what do you see when it's, what do you see when a new team comes up? You see that it's, they either go straight back down or they finish like top 10 and then they struggle the season after. Sheffield United, you know, same thing. Because they get found out, don't they? Then people know the game style, then whether, because they don't necessarily have the greatest talents, that they're just, it's all about the work rate, isn't it? And I'm sure I read a stat a few weeks back saying they've dropped the running in the game by like 20% or something. That's like a major thing for Leeds. That was what they were all about last season.
It was their MO, wasn't it? It was their MO on the field. Like, they would go out there and they would choke the teams all over the field. High press everywhere on, you know, try and win the ball as close to the goal as possible to increase your chances of creating goal scoring opportunities. But I think Bielsa, do you reckon his training regimen is kind of like depleted a lot? And he said, like, we can't keep this up, unsustainable because of all the injuries they're getting as well. And are all the injuries as a result of his high-intensity training regime as well? Well,
can't you just feel, if it's as simple as the high rate of work closing down all over the pitch, can't you start lifting up lads from the U21s, U23s?
Kind of what Gerrard's been doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Isn't that like a bit of a stopgap solution until the boys come back post-February? And like, I know it's not that simple.
Obviously, yeah, like, they might not necessarily be ready, you know, like he's given, Gerrard, for example, is giving like that Chukwuemeka maker like 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So
he's easing him in.
But yeah, it is strange, isn't it? Because you would have expected, no one would have said they would have been in a relegation battle now this season, would you? You know,
nah, not at all.
But then you can, like you say, you can blame it on all sorts, like the injuries. You never know. You don't know what the main reason is. You don't know if, like, what the players are thinking of Bielsa or anything, you know.
He looked like a dejected man on the sidelines last night anyway. He let a head in his hands, sitting on an upturned bucket. That's not what you want to see your manager doing. Do you know what I mean?
I don't blame him for looking dejected after playing Man City, though, because they're just... Do you know what I mean? But it never rains. It pours for Bielsa. Like, and Leeds, their next three games, Arsenal, Liverpool. And then they're going to play Villa. If Villa beat Burnley and they get a good result against Chelsea, Villa are going to be like raring to go, aren't they?
And
Leeds lose both them games. Now they're going to be playing Villa
again straight away in like the start of Feb.
Quite conceivably, they could be bottom of the table, man. Come start of January, and then they're going to have to invest.
What you always have to think, like, are the three worst teams in Leeds? And I think at the moment there are
Norwich,
definitely
Burnley.
I think Burnley, yeah, and I think Watford.
Newcastle?
Watford.
So there's four teams.
I think Newcastle will get out of there, to be honest.
Newcastle will give it a
scratch. See what they can do tonight. They got, because Wilson's on fire, to be fair. He's got 9 in 13 or something like that. So that's a good ratio for, they just need to stop conceding. Have you seen who they want to sign?
Mm-hmm.
Kieran Trippier, they say they'll make him his highest paid player.
What, 33 years old?
Yeah, that's how it starts, man. You got to get the ball rolling somehow, man. Elano and the lads. Oh my God, Martin Petro.
What was that one, Giovanni? Who did he play for? Paul.
Didn't he
go to City? I'm sure he went to City.
He went to Ipswich as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
Who did Elano?
Did you say Elano?
Elano. He was scoring bangers for jokes.
Steven Ireland.
Man City had the Brazilian flex, didn't they? Like, do you know what I mean? Straight away when the first.
Remember they got Mike on for a bit, right?
Yeah. I do remember that.
Yeah, he was done on like Pez,
all the Brazilians were wicked for like 6 months and they absolutely disappeared. That Amezaki, I think we just signed him on FIFA from Wigan.
They all go to the carnival, don't they? Like, Neymar's always injured at the same time of the year. It's like,
well, let's talk about Arteta and what's going on with him and Aubameyang, because it's a bit of a weird situation, really. And obviously, Arsenal, they've not had much luck in electing captains in the past sort of decade. I think their last nine have either sort of done one after basically getting the captaincy, and then they've gone to like Alexon went to Barcelona, Robin Van Persie went to United, and then you've got Vermaelen, who was like always injured. You got a lot, Arteta, I think he was captain, he was injured quite a lot as well. Who's the other Mertesacker? Classic,
like, but what about
one infamous list?
But what about But that's kind of the day in that, like the new age of footballers, they don't stay at clubs. So it's not like like you're going to have a Tony Adams where he's going to be captain from like 21 and then never leave and be captain for his whole life. You know,
well, if you focus on the issue with Aubameyang, I don't think we can criticise his performances like up until about 8 or 9 months ago for Arsenal. Pretty lethal as a striker, scored some big games. But
I'd
like,
say even further than that, to be honest. It's probably over a year now.
Maybe so. But like he was stripped of his captaincy for returning late from France, wasn't it? That's what
Do you know what he was doing in France as well?
Don't know.
He was looking after his ill mum.
Yeah, but
this can't be the only incident.
No, but the thing is, well, you gotta go back to the game before where he came on after Nketiah, and everyone was saying that was like a huge disrespect to him, that you're going to bring on Aubameyang after Nketiah. So there must have been already stuff going on, whatever. But what I've heard about this returning late thing is he hasn't phoned Arteta to tell him that he's going to be late. So all it takes is a phone call, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
What sort of example is he setting as a captain? Is like, what's Smith Rowe thinking? I'll just come in late tomorrow and it'll be all right, you know.
I seen what's his name? The ex Newcastle keeper Robinson. Was he what's his name?
Paul Robinson.
He was talking on Sky Sports News. He's saying if a player consistently turns up late to training or to meetings or whatever, it breeds a certain feeling within the dressing room, and everyone's like, okay, so he's late again. So why am I getting bollockings for this when he's not getting bollockings for that?
I see it with my band at rehearsals. You know, if one person says, oh, I'm going to be half an hour late, then everyone else thinks, all right, I'll just turn up half an hour late. Yeah. But that's not how it should be. You know, if this person's obviously late for a reason or whatever, that doesn't mean everyone else needs to follow suit. You know, it's not a good example.
So big up your own culture, by the way.
Big up your culture.
Didn't even give him a plug at the beginning. Meant to do that.
I was going
to
plug at the end, but you know,
I will do it at the end as well.
You could just plug all the way through. But Flynn, what about you? What if you're a manager of a small team, which you are because you're a big businessman? Do you know what I mean?
Company man.
At your fingertips on the pulse of the sub market. So what would you do if you had like three or four team members that were consistently like, you know, not abiding the rules and turn up late for work and all that shit? What would you do?
I'd make a public example of them in the name of the company.
of course.
What would you do? Just let it happen. Just let anarchy.
Sack them straight away. That's what you do.
Right before Christmas.
it's one of them, isn't it? You know, I feel like he could have just let them know, and he might have evaded all these problems. But
well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, before any I even knew there was discontent between Aubameyang and Arteta, I heard Arsene Wenger publicly criticise Aubameyang, saying he wasn't the player I thought he was going to be when I signed him. He's not doing the job. He's not setting the example. And this was weeks ago.
Yeah.
So obviously something's filtered through to Wenger. He's put it out there on the next one, and now we're getting this like circular consequence of
can someone explain to me why Aubameyang is captain in the first place?
Goal scoring, maybe.
That's a very good point.
I think you've got to look in like Arsenal's quite a young squad. I think you've got to look to experience.
Who do you put
players.
On there? Who do you put?
And you know they made captain now. Apparently, Lacazette.
Doesn't
make any sense.
I think that's a bad choice.
That's out of the frying pan into the fire, isn't it?
Decisions at Arsenal for the last 10 years have been questionable.
Lacazette hasn't been a mainstay in the Arsenal team for quite a few years.
It seems like he takes off Aubameyang to bring Lacazette on, or he takes off Lacazette and brings Aubameyang on. Obviously, they're giving it to Lacazette for now, but is that a permanent selection?
I don't think so. I think, that's just a solution to a problem, isn't it?
Got a quick question about Lacazette. So he's going to be the new captain?
At the moment, he was captain for tonight, I think.
And so we were talking about he's not shown much proficiency on the pitch. Was that right? Is that what you said?
He's a good player, but he's been a bit part striker, mainly a substitute. He scored a lot of goals. A lot of assists, but there's been speculation over him going elsewhere for a long time.
Even to the likes of Man United, wasn't there?
Oh, like, Neves! Arsenal! Send them to Chelsea, send them to City, send them to United. Everyone who's going to beat you 5-0 down the road. I fucking hate Arsenal.
Well, I reckon Tommy T is on the phone to Aubameyang right now, as I was saying. Oh, do you want to come back, mate? You know, we had a great relationship with Dortmund.
Then he goes to Chelsea, 30-goal season. Fucking Neves, man.
It's Arsenal.
It sounds to me like a good company man move, making him captain then. And I'll explain why. I'll tell you why.
Go on, Footsie Flynn.
So maybe we're saying on the pitch, maybe he's not all that when he, you know, well, except when he does get on the pitch. But maybe behind the scenes now, if I'm the boss, I want someone who's well liked amongst the players, and I want someone who's going to do my bidding. And if he's good and there's a chance of him going somewhere else, I'm going to give him a little bump up just for a bit.
Yes,
to be honest, though, with that point Flynn's made, that's maybe why Aubameyang was captain. Because he's well liked. The kids are all going to be like, wow, Aubameyang's sick, you know, like he's going to score goals. But imagine you give it to the likes of Ben White, who's just joined, or Tierney, who's been there for a season.
You'll piss everyone off doing that.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. You can't go around it.
No, but I do think at the elite level, you need to give captaincy based on the content of people's characters.
Yeah, how long they've been there.
Like that's like, yeah. If I'm coaching an under-8s team, I'll be like, oh, give it to Bobby, he's the best player.
Or it's like saying you can't come in and be a manager of like a business, like because you're a new guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but
like, which it doesn't matter, does it?
Which is a ridiculous company culture.
Yeah, but we all know that it's not a meritocracy. Sport is hardly ever a meritocracy. There's so many...
No jabbies.
That's what I'm saying. We're human.
No jabbies.
We're human beings dealing with each other in the best way we know how. Football and managing a football club and a football team, massive commercial enterprise, and it's results-based. You need to manage the dynamic within the dressing room as best you can. And I think both of you, Stitch and Flynn, have hit upon like a pretty astute psychological observation there. You need to play your best hand. Now, it might not seem to us like it's the best hand, but we're on the outside. They're on the inside. Yeah, now, Aubameyang is probably backfired 100%. A little bit. Well, I mean, because, you know, whatever, he's being at a shit house and not dropping phone calls when he should.
But you hear about it with, like, players, not necessarily captains, but you hear about, like, oh, why are they keeping so-and-so at the club? And it's like, well, because he's actually in the dressing room and he's uplifting all of these players. Like, Ashley Young has come to Villa and he's effectively another coach. You know, he's like, they're saying that his value to the club
is more because
the kids look up to him and he's helping Gerrard as well at the same time. So
same with Dean at Blues.
Whilst
really,
doing his badges. Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Dean at Blues has come back and although initially Blues weren't great in terms of results, I feel like he brought a certain passion back to the club from the fans, and
he just changed
the atmosphere around the place.
And even as a Villa fan, it was nice to see this guy returning to his hometown. He's never played for them. Him like hearing interviews from him saying that he's always wanted to play for them, and like his family were crying and so, you know what I mean? It's like, you see how much it means to them, you know. So it's one of
the fucking Brummies, man.
You know, that raises an interesting point again. I hadn't considered Ashley Young. Villa are in a bit of a perfect storm at the minute, aren't they? They've got, look how much experience Ashley Young's got with United. How long was he there for?
Like
7-8 years.
Least,
Champions League experience.
What did he left Villa when he was what, 23?
Well, he left Villa and then he must have been around 23.
8 years, probably 31.
He joined Villa when he was what, like 18, 19.
From Watford.
Yeah. And then he was there for a good like 3-4 years, wasn't he? And then he's gained so much experience out, like,
and now if he's actually
winning the Serie A as well, like even that, like just late on in
mental, that is, isn't it?
He's had a good career, man. And talking of other 18-year-olds,
he did win the Serie A, didn't he?
We're often talking about 18-year-olds in the privacy era. I won't call him a legend. Is he a Blues legend?
Bobby Savage is a Blues legend. Oh. You know he is as well, because like you're going back to the days where.
Went on the nut, didn't he, man?
From Big Dion.
Yeah. But obviously, Robbie Savage's son Charlie makes his Manchester United debut in a dead rubber, Jim.
Well, that, you know, I spotted that.
What's a dead rubber?
Just a game that means nothing.
Thank you.
He's read that Wikipedia page that you created, obviously.
Yeah, go on, Flynn. You tell him, mate.
Is it like an ice hockey term or something?
It's got to be. It's got to be a fucking lacrosse term, I reckon. Lacrosse.
He made his debut whilst his dad nearly like ejaculated over the commentary.
he was working for BT Sport at the time, man, and he was just like... And he's like, Robbie.
A great moment for the Savage.
I'm gonna let you bring him on. He's like, well, he doesn't manage the team. Like, you know what I mean? he's only calling the game.
Like father and like son, like Robbie Savage has failed, man. No,
it brought a little bit of warmth to my heart, I think. Because not for you, because I hate Savage, but obviously his father's already achieved what he couldn't, which is actually get a first team appearance for United, even though Robbie Savage was there for years as a youth. Like, he never made his first year appearance. He got a pro contract, but never
put
made
in a dead rubber.
Put in the dead
rubber. Like, rubbers. Are you going to be, goes back to the point of, are you going to be happy if you score your first England goal against San Marino?
Are you going to be happy?
It's a good shout.
Are you going to be happy? Are you going to be happy that you made your debut? I think that doesn't change the occasion. I feel like both points, like the debut and the like scoring your first like international goal, regardless of who it's against, you're always going to be buzzing in it and remember it. But like it does kind of take the
definitely. Yeah. I know what you mean.
Like, look at the likes of like Gerrard and stuff, and people like back in the day, like Rooney, like the debuts that they had, where they come on and they score like amazing goals, like compared to just coming on for 20 minutes against Young Boys when it's like
you can't really hope for those kind of debuts, though, can you? I mean, if we're referring to Rooney's debut for United against Fenerbahce, scoring a hat trick,
exactly,
polishing half of a free kick, like it's unreal
in the Champions League. Like,
yeah, it's I don't.
But you know what I'm saying? But in that sense,
I know what you mean.
Like you're going to be buzzing either way, but you want to be kind of making it. You want to be like fighting your way into the team. He hasn't been on the edge, has he, of the team?
I know what your point is. You feel like that he hasn't got there based on merit. He's kind of just been thrown a bit of a bone and a chance to go on and sort of like represent the club.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of clubs were doing that, like during this Europa League period, when they had games that didn't really mean much. Like they would put about three or four young lads on the bench. And they'd give them like the odd minutes and give them their.
Yeah, yeah.
It does feel a bit ceremonial, doesn't it? Rather than sort of like they've got their based on merit.
Yeah,
because obviously back in the day, in like the '90s, you'd have like three subs.
Yeah, it's like just
give. You wouldn't have like ten subs. It's like, on the all right, bench,
like, save Harry Kane the trip to Kazakhstan. Let's play James Wood.
like Harry Kane, all the lads.
Harry Kane would be on the plane to Kazakhstan, you know?
I will be. To get his seven goals against Samurai.
Get them goals in, yeah.
England's on top goal scorer.
That's get me back on for that one. That's another. That's for another day, that is.
Saying that though, surely that's a good way to manage a team is in these lesser important games, get some of the untested dudes out.
I agree with that in the sense, but I just meant more for the actual player's achievement, you know, because he might not ever play for Man U again now, you know.
Yeah, but he's not going to care. He's coming at Old Trafford and representing United. Even if he goes and play for Dulwich Hamlet.
So it's one of those, it's on the line, isn't it? You're going to be buzzing, but then is he going to be successful? You never know.
You can only find out if he's going to be successful if you try him out in games like this. So.
He clearly didn't get there on a merit of his name anyway.
He's got 346 appearances in the Premier League, man.
For who?
What do you mean for who? For who? Blackburn, Leicester,
Blues. Blackburn.
The Titans.
Take it back, man. The good old Warbles.
Damien Duff and the boys.
Yeah, yeah.
David Dunn. Another Blues legend, David Dunn.
But number two, Floyd Mounier Webber's former rival, Marcus Maidan. I'm sure you heard about this maybe a year ago, but this might still be a one thing you missed because I missed it. He claims he still has the undefeated champ's tooth from their highly contested bout in 2014. Maidan has supposedly knocked Maywood's tooth out with a fierce strike in the third round. And the Argentine has since made a pendant out of it.
So, Mayweather's denied losing his tooth. He was quoted as...
$500,000.
Well, he was quoted as saying, he hit me with that shot after the bell. It was a real good shot. It got my attention. But no, he didn't knock my teeth out. Not at all. Now, I watched a video on YouTube today, and it does show him getting smacked in the face, and it shows something flying out of his mouth. But you never know these days. Someone could have put anything in, you know, with the age of deep fake and video editing these days. It could have been a fake, and I haven't been able to find out if that was confirmed to be real or not. But he denies it. But that's pretty brutal. That's pretty brutal, putting someone's tooth in a pendant. What do you reckon?
But, you know, I remember this fight, and it was Floyd Mayweather had just moved from HBO to Showtime. He signed a 6-fight deal from being like 34, 35 years old. It's mad. Like, why would you do this? But it's worth like $150 million. He fought Robert Guerrero in his first fight, scored him up, beat Canelo in his second fight, took him down to 152, fought Marcus Maidana in his third fight, which is this one. And people were shocked to death about how difficult of a night Marcus Maidana made it for him. Now, Maidana had just beaten Adrian Broner, handed him his first defeat, knocked him down twice on the way to a unanimous decision victory for the WBA welterweight title. He gave Mayweather all he could handle. He's got like unorthodox looping punches, hits really, really hard, as durable as you like. I remember a lot of people screaming robbery at the time, which was an absolute joke because Mayweather was like clear 116, 112 winner, but it warranted a rematch after that. And then Mayweather just schooled him after that. So it seems like even if it is true, it doesn't matter, does it, man? I think like Marcus Maidana got the two best paydays of his life. I think he went up to like £250 after that.
Sour grapes, isn't it? It's got to be sour grapes.
No. It's like a G move, but like it's one of those ways to get like a bit of get a bit of credit over something like. It's like touching greatness.
Yeah.
That's what he's doing. He's touching greatness.
He thinks he's in the Vietnam War or something, you know, where they used to cut the ears off, wear people's ears on their neck.
Exactly.
He's got a lot of heads hanging in his wardrobe.
Yeah. He was on the losing side of the battle, which doesn't make any sense. Anyway, yeah.
There's some controversial boxing as well, wasn't there? Did you see it the other day? The Bradley Ski.
Oh, mate, don't talk about that, mate. We watched it.
That's mad,
mate.
That is, isn't
Excuse
it,
me, we were. Yeah. Oh, stop. I'm going to pat my forehead now. It's not just because of
it. He's got a history of doing it. He's done it before as well. I didn't
know about that.
He's done it before, yeah.
Oi, I didn't know about that. We'll have to revisit that.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Conspiratorial. I'm going to reference that later on, but like... Not to the same extent. That's proper pissed me off again. Look, thinking about that. Three punches when he's on the ground. Oh, 1 point deducted.
Don't get Jim started, man.
Don't stop.
Open that window.
Don't bring it. That's the boxer.
We'll do number three. What has Dana White done to his mum that she made him so dirty? She's come out with some fairly slanderous comments regarding her son, saying that he bangs UFC ring girls, uses steroids, and he's even slept with his sister-in-law, Ryan Giggs style.
But to be fair, I actually find none of this unbelievable. I mean, he clearly does steads. If you're the head of the UFC, you would bang the ring girls, wouldn't you? Let's be honest. But his sister-in-law, that's like, what's going on? And his mum, I don't know what the context of the interview was, but his mum just looks like he completely hates on him, or she completely hates on him.
Dana White's got a lot going on in his life anyway. Trust me. How does he stay sane?
And he gambles all the time.
I know he's got no hair, that's a sign, isn't it?
Whoa, chill out, man. Shots fired.
And his head's grown. Apparently that's a real telltale sign of a certain... human growth hormone. Yeah. Not all the steds, just HDH. Yeah, yes, you'll see the same if you
know exactly which one is on as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, if the head grows, it's a telltale sign of that certain steroid. Apparently, a lot of people online reckon Joe Rogan's been hitting it hard. Like I showed you guys early picture of Joe Rogan from the 90s with his regular head, and now he's got no neck and he's this huge head.
But his mum says he uses steroids.
That's not all she said. She went to town on him. I watched the interview today. She was like, oh, his grandmother, she was dying last year. He called the grandmother and said, don't worry, I'll get you a private jet to come visit me and I'll put you up and look after you. And then they never heard from him again. she's in the hospital or the hospice telling all the staff. She's saying, oh, my grandson's coming to get me in a private jet soon. He never turned up.
But, I'm reading here as well. Didn't attend the grandmother's
funeral. But he didn't go to the funeral either. But this is all... So this interview happened about 10 years ago, funnily enough. For some reason, it's back in the news, and I'm not sure why. I've been trying to find out why, but...
Someone's digging some dirt on him.
Now we're
sure,
talking,
man.
Flynn. Now we're talking. Yeah. This is what I'm all about here.
Right, she did the interview about 10 years ago because she'd written a book about him, like a biography, and it was called Dana White, King of MMA, and basically it's just her shitting all over him. And she did the interview to promote the book. Now, I found some old links of the interview from 10 years ago. When you click on them, it goes to YouTube and it says, this video has got a copyright strike from the UFC. So he's been shutting this down for 10 years.
It's still creeping out. Censor it all across all boards. It's still creeping from the woodworks.
This is a good quote. What is it? She said he puts Tiger Woods to shame with his nightlife style.
Tiger Woods, the OG womanizer.
But yeah, for some reason it's come back out again. I don't know if she's got another book on the way, or the sales haven't been doing so good, or I don't know, man. It's a weird story. I think we should look more into this.
Yeah, because I thought when I looked at the video footage, I thought that looks a bit like grainy, and surely nowadays everything looks shiny and new now. So I was thinking, where
looks
like
one of them old school
from?
Taliban videos.
Yeah. Yeah, she's trying to behead Dana. So good job getting that fucking thing off your shoulders anyway, man.
jokes. I said it before. The investigation continues with the bullying of female jockey Bryony Frost. You probably heard about this on Sportsbook as well. A fellow jockey named Robbie Dunn.
He's on the jocks.
Subjected her to verbal and physical abuse, which included an incident in which he opened his towel and shook himself in front of her. He had also threatened to cause her harm on numerous occasions and has last week been found guilty of bullying and harassment and subsequently banned for 18 months with three months suspended. So Frost, who's 26 and the daughter of Grand National Women jockey Jimmy Frost, criticised the Professional Jockey Association for failing to support her adequately and a plea to support future jockeys in need.
I heard an interview from another jockey, female jockey, and she said she couldn't really comment on it because it hadn't happened to her. But they were asking whether she had felt bullying in the weighing room.
Yeah, yeah.
So she'd asked if there was any bullying in the weighing room. And what her response was, there's a lot of, say, hard banter, you know, where if you get in my way, I'm going to ram you off the track. Like, you know what I mean? So so she said she doesn't know whether that sort of stuff has got to her, Bryony Frost, and affected her in a different way. And she's felt targeted by it, you know. So it's hard when you're in the weighing room. It's the only sport where you're going to be in a room with all your competitors, aren't you? And that, like, you're all getting ready together and you're going to go and battle against each other.
And especially when, like, 95% of them are blokes as well.
And you're
a young 26-year-old jockey. There's going to be a bit of a weird dynamic going in there. When you got Tony McCoy, who's like 40.
You don't know what her mentality is beforehand, whether she's intimidated or not, or... Because
I think it'd be completely understandable for her to be intimidated.
Exactly.
Think if you just take our mates, for example, right? We're like kind of brutal the way we speak to each other. And if we've known each other for a long time, and it's very much like a lads atmosphere. And I think, say, if you're this Bryony coming in, like, you'd be very much aware of that. And then you would feel like, okay, how do I proceed? And then when you get there and you're met with the hard banter, I'm not like saying that.
And then some geezer gets his dick out.
That's what I'm going to say.
No. I wasn't about to say, like, because if someone got the dick out in front of me, I'd be like, what is actually happening here? Like, where? What kind of kicks are you trying to get out of this situation?
Not defending him, though, but you're taking her word for it again, aren't you? You know, who else has anyone else said they witnessed it? You know, it's...
Fair point.
It's one of those, isn't it? You know, like, if you're getting changed in a room together, maybe his dick was out, you know?
Or if you're two people getting changed...
I'm not defending him, but I'm saying you know, it's like, it's on the line, isn't it? Where things happen behind closed doors. You're never going to know, are you?
No, but I get what you're saying. And I agree with you to the point where that could have happened. And the two of them are in the room and it could have happened. And she could have made something more of it than it actually was. On the other hand, if he's that kind of creep, he would wait.
Exactly.
Until
there's
only two of
them there. Exactly. He easily just be as, but it is a dodgy one, isn't it? Where, like I said,
we're not privy to all the information, are we?
Also, if you did get your cock out, just don't get your cock out.
Well, like we said,
in the room, especially.
And Bissett, you said we're not privy to all the information, but the people who apparently are privy to the information have banned and suspended him.
Yeah, the proof's in the pudding.
But look, it's if you don't back the woman and then she doesn't get the justice, then maybe they've just covered their asses by just backing her. Because if you say, right, we don't think that's true, then it all kicks off like the Yorkshire cricket racist scandal. Then, you know, if they denied it, like, that was the worst thing they could have ever done, you know?
That's absolutely true as well, because I would never expect a sporting body to be the most... empathetic group of people. I think they'd be self-serving, and I think they'd be very much, okay, how do we lock this down for our own benefit regardless of what's going on? And again, it's unless we're in the room, we're fucked up.
You never know, like you said, what her mind state was like, you know, beforehand, whether it maybe her dad had said just be wary in there. You know, if her dad was a jockey, say there's going to be some lads in there, you know. But as well, how old was the jockey that got suspended? What age was it, you know?
I just wanted to make the quick point, though, is that obviously with these kind of situations, there's always a he said, she said, or he said, or whatever kind of situation. And history is generally shown that people kind of don't take the victim's side. We've seen this through years of women not wanting to report rape and things like that. And these days there's a bit more of a change towards just listening to the victim and taking the claim seriously, then investigating. So I think we can talk about banter and things like that, but it sounds like this is almost like a sexual assault. This guy just trying to fuck with her so much, maybe just trying to put her off the game. That was probably the intent, but he's there getting his cock out and shaking it around. And I think it's important to take her side really seriously on this one.
Yeah, I agree. Sorry, Bissett's just said, like, he's 42. The geezer was 42 years old. So you tell me, like,
so he's probably thinking he runs that way if he's acting like that.
And he probably has a certain level of respect in there because of his age and because I don't know.
But that's how abuse takes place, is when a person in that position of power knows they can act like that in front of people, and then a person in a lesser position of power can't do fuck all.
Not
that
saying it's right either, but as well, it's like, if you've got a power that keeps getting his dick out or whatever, it's like, and the lads will find it funny, like you said, the lads mentality. Maybe he's just done that, and he's thinking she's going to find it funny.
That could be part of it.
That's the opposite, you know. And I'm not saying it's right, but that's the opposite, you know. So there's
apparently he's been calling her a cunt and all.
Yeah, but listen, that could be part of it. But I gotta be honest, my own personal inclination when I'm hearing his age, her age, the dynamic 95% men, I'm leaning towards him being. Dirty bastard.
Exactly. I'm saying the same, but I just think it can never be. He's probably doing the same. He's probably doing the same on the track to the other guys, isn't he? You know, and whatever, and calling them every word under the sun, you know, and it's like.
We should get either of them in here, to be fair. See if he gets his cock out in front of us.
Wait, just before we do, basically, I'm saying at best, this dude is a dickhead. At best.
All right, so I think that you can fairly have the final word there, company man, Flynn. All right, last one for the five things, and it's a little bit of a quick one. I believe he's caught this. Mike Perry, former UFC fighter, in just after his debut, is it BKFC, BFC? Is it one of these bare knuckle boxing organizations? He's commentating on one of the fights, and then his upcoming opponent is in the crowd, threw something at him. Mike Perry's like, nah, fuck this. Took his headphones off, and then they started brawling over the guardrail, like grabbing each other and punching. But I will say, before you, I don't know if you've caught the footage of this, whatever. I thought it looked like pure WWE,
like drama, drama, scripted drama.
Because these lads know how to throw hands, and they were like had each other in collar ties, and they were like giving them each other like they had their fists clenched, but they were like open hand, like slapping each other with it.
Why I order?
Why I order?
Hold me back. No one's holding me back.
But also, I think it's a great way to promote a fight. I think that boxing and MMA needs more of this shit.
I was going to say, UFC need to do it a little bit more, man. But they do it, but they do it in the press conferences where all the cameras watch it. But I like that. It's a bit subtle, man.
Yeah.
I like it.
Because if you're watching the bare knuckle boxing's broadcast, all you see is something hit Mike Perry's t-shirt. That's all you see.
That's class.
And it's like, he's turning around. He's like, it was something like that, something equally innocuous. And he's turning around. He's like, no, I'm not having that. It was good acting up to that point, but the exchanges, I wasn't convinced.
Especially from these guys who are meant to be like combat.
Yeah. Like, they could fuck each other up, man. Quick sound.
But let's review the madness from UFC and the boxing this weekend.
Oh, are we quizzing?
Unless you've got questions,
Quizlamic State.
I've got a question. Quizlamic State. See that? Liam did it. Fucking hell.
These keep coming, man. Every week it's a new one. Quizlamic State.
We did that as our pub quiz team name last year here.
Oh, shit, man. That is fucking joke.
So what? Are you doing the quiz then?
I've got one question. Well, it's a double question, so I've got two questions on the same topic for all of you.
Yeah, go on then.
And it should work with all three of you. It's about basketball. First question is going to be who's closest. Well, get the phone away. No phones in my quiz.
I'm checking live score. I just wanted to check the score.
And the basketball.
I thought you were going to do questions about Formula One. I've been looking at Formula One stats in case something like that come up.
I was actually writing one up as Stitch came. I was writing a quiz question up, and I was like, I can't do it now, really.
What was it going to be?
It was going to be, I think it was going to be how many titles have a certain... I didn't decide which country it was going to be. But it's going to be how many titles have a certain country got. I think maybe Brazil.
Well, I wouldn't have got it. I saw Schumacher's got seven titles. Hamilton's got seven.
Yeah.
Senna got three. He's Brazilian.
All right.
There's a couple of others.
I think it was eight. No, it
weren't eight, you know.
All right.
I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what. It's daily now. This
Daily Mail. All right. How many wins has Argentina got?
In F1?
Of all time?
What, like wins of races?
How many drivers' championship wins?
Two.
Four.
None.
Five. Four. Jim gets it. Who was the first winner?
The first winner ever?
The first.
I looked it up today. It's some Italian geezer, Giuseppe Verini. He's the first ever.
Giuseppe Farina.
Well done, Flynn.
I told you.
You can't preempt.
Oh, yeah, but you can study. You can study.
If a top flight team wins this week, they'll be the first team to win 2,000 top flight games. Who would the team be?
Arsenal.
Man U.
Everton.
Liverpool.
Oh, I didn't have
it.
Is the top flight? I was thinking Everton have been like in the top flight for donkey's years. All right, I've got one last one, then we're gonna do Flynn's.
All right.
Just gonna flip through.
I thought you was a liberal, mate. It's just Daily Mail, dude.
It's Daily Mail. Like, well, come on.
You know what? Got us last week.
The sports sections are good and the quiz crosswords are good.
Deb got us a treat last week. She said she voted for Bissett Conservative while he was away because she had control of his vote.
That's illegal.
Oh, shit. I'm not saying which Deb. Just a bit.
Right, here we go.
So, she was proper happy about it as well. She loved it. Like,
that's fucked up.
Record will become the 10th player of all time to play in 150 test matches. Can you name any of the other nine?
Nasser Hussain.
So let's repeat the question for me.
No. Stuart Broad.
Yeah.
Will become, when he plays in the test in the Ashes, whether it be this one, I think it is going to be this one, that starts tomorrow. He will become the 10th player to ever appear in 150 test matches. Who are the other, who are the nine players above him?
Ken Peterson.
James Anderson.
Yes.
Shane Warne.
A point.
England.
A point. England, there's one other England player in there.
Who's the dude who went on I'm a Celebrity? Phil Tufnell. Is it Phil Tufnell, a cricket guy?
No. Nah.
Michael Vaughan.
Nah, I don't know.
No.
Shane Warne.
No.
the top
guy is Indian.
I've got
Nev!
Sachin Tendulkar.
Yeah. There's two Aussies below him.
As always.
Ricky Ponting.
Yeah.
It's always a good night with two Aussies underneath you.
Well, dude, you got about 3 points. How did you get?
I got loads, mate. Don't worry about it.
Flynn had questions.
Yeah.
All right.
Ask question.
All right. Here's the real question.
What botched fucking quiz that was?
He was impromptu.
For the first question, you're going to have to answer in order by order of your surname. So Alan, then Bissett, then Young.
Oh, right. There's a lot of pressure there.
Right. Again, according to Wikipedia, much more reliable than the Daily fucking Mail. Anyway, according to Wikipedia, in what year was basketball invented? Jim Allen, you're up first.
I'll go for 1910.
1910. Okay, Bissett, over to you.
That could be open to interpretation. Like who invented it for a start?
There's a name of the man who invented it. Yeah,
it's lawn basketball, isn't it?
It's not like tennis or football it's not like those other sports where there was ancient versions like horse racing or football. Like that, it was very clear cut. A dude invented it in this year.
Go for 19.
No, any basketballers to fight in the war, Second World War?
1932. You went 1910. And Stitch, over to you. What year was basketball invented?
1948.
It's got to go to Jim. It was 1891. No.
Yeah, mate. You went there, wasn't you?
Closest one.
Bonus point. So whoever's closer, like last time, whoever's closest to the city. In which city was it invented?
Go reverse order this time, Sean.
Yeah, right.
If you want.
Good job, mate.
Stitch.
You're pulling the shots.
I'm the winner, aren't I, from the first point? I'm screwing.
I'm loading up Google Maps so I can measure the distances. But yeah, Stitch, which city was it invented in?
City, so not state, no.
I'm going to go with city.
All right. Philadelphia.
Philadelphia. Okay. And then, Bissett, it's to you.
Brooklyn,
okay.
It's a borough, isn't it?
It's not the city. It's all going to New York for you.
He lives there, like, fucking terrible, this.
And Jim, over to you.
I'll go left field. I'll go Indianapolis.
Nice.
All right, so it was in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Ooh.
Which I believe is pretty close to Philadelphia and New York.
Yeah.
So we're gonna have to Google Maps it.
Let's give me Philadelphia.
Oh, if you chose Boston, you would have got it, mate.
That's what I was gonna say, man.
But maybe you've still got it. So you went for Philadelphia. So the distance.
Not in mind, no.
Yeah, I'm gonna, because Indianapolis. No, that's a lot further over west, I think.
Yeah, you better fucking go further that way.
Philadelphia kind of does that. We've got New York's huge. So it's hard to say.
We're going to go the driving distance between Philadelphia and Springfield. Let's look it up now.
Yeah, that's going to be you.
What's the state? Springfield, what?
New York's further.
Massachusetts.
And I said New York City, isn't it? New York City, right.
So... there's three different distances. I'm going to go for the shortest one they've given. If you go by the I-95 from Springfield to Philadelphia, 233 miles. That's what you've got, Stitch.
233.
New York City.
Far away.
New York City.
New York City.
New York City.
I want to recap. 142.
Oh!
And then where are we going? Indianapolis.
That was an unfair question because
of
the Yank.
Yeah, that's true. And he's like Brooklyn.
Well, let's do Indianapolis. Just we've not missed any then.
50 miles, is it? Yeah, nice one.
857.
A distant third.
So I thought you was going to ask. This would probably be on the things you might have missed next week. Steph Curry broke the number of threes, the 3-pointer, like 2,973 or something. Yeah. If you would have asked that.
So who was behind him?
Allen.
Who was behind him?
God. No, but I thought Steph Curry broke that record a long time ago.
No,
he's just broken it.
What was his first name? Allen.
Ray Allen.
Right, who did he play for?
Ray Allen's got the perfect free technique, apparently, like how you should learn how to
that's fucking. That's actually sick. I'd like to learn more about
he's
that.
He's a wealth of sports knowledge, to be fair, isn't
he? Segway King as well.
He's going to start his own.
Segway is.
Going to be a rival.
Rival, yeah. It was Reggie Miller.
Reggie Miller. I know that name. Don't know anything about him, though.
He played for Indianapolis, funny enough.
That's why he was thinking.
The Segway King, right there.
Right, are we going to do this fucking job? Let's pause.
Yeah,
it
we are. Yeah. All right. Well, it's a peculiar thing. There's been a recent public debate around UFC fighter pay, but they continue to provide the most exhilarating contests in combat sports, to be honest with you. And UFC 269 was no different. I'll start with the biggest shock of the night for me. But
I love the way you said the biggest shock of the night.
Would you like to talk about my predictions that I sent you? Which were completely off.
Join the club, man, because
it's a tradition.
It's impossible to predict, man. And I'll let you go on, Bissett, but I will counteract you in a second.
No, I was just going to say, because watching this back and the way we've spoke about Amanda Nunes in the past, and I think the general rhetoric coming from the sporting world about this, that it was one of the biggest shocks in the UFC of all time. For you to write biggest shock of the night.
No, look, it was a mass. I did not expect this to happen, but I will bring us back to a little statement I made last week, is that every time I speak this confidently about a UFC fighter winning, they fucking lose, man.
Mm-hmm.
Every time they lose, because it's the most unpredictable sport you can think of.
The gym curse. He's like the Peyton Manning curse, isn't it? But he's gym. Anybody he speaks about on the pod.
After you begin the Chinese woman, man. You know.
Oh, stop. It's unreal.
From heart, that is.
Amanda Nunes. I thought there was literally as close as a certainty as you can get to winning the fight. But Juliana Pena, she was unreal, man. And it's not to say that Amanda Nunes was even looking lethargic, or she looked overweight, or she looked distracted. The first thing she did in the fight was grapple with a leg kick. And she got on top of her. She threatened the choke from the back.
It's the beauty of UFC, isn't it? That but then you've seen at the end of the fight where she was just getting walked back and back, It was quite a shock, man, to be honest, when I saw the highlights.
No, it was unreal. And
apart from the first 45 seconds where it looked like the game had frozen UFC.
Yeah.
Is that not going to make a move?
Yeah, they're both in idle position, weren't they?
Fainting stale, mate. But Juliana Pena was really heavy on the front leg. So when Amanda Nunes dropped that right leg kick, she put her on her arm straight away. And then she was really patient, trying to get past the open guard. Again, Juliana Pena got back to her feet. And Amanda Nunes, in the first round, there was no hint at all that she was going to lose that fight. She dropped the front kick to the body, dropped a straight right hand after there, put Pena on her ass, got all the way to the back. And I think Pena was about 2 seconds away from getting completely choked out. She scrambled to a single leg, got her back up. Nunes took her down again. And then she secured a Kimura position, which stopped her getting choked out, which basically took her to the end of the round.
That was good defense. Great defense from Pena.
I don't know about Pena, but like from what I know about Nunes, watched a few fights, like, do you think it's a mentality thing where she, like, everyone convinced her she was going to win, you know, and she didn't go for that clinical finish. Like, compared to when she's been up against harder opponents, more to say, like, you know.
Well, I think she, when she won the title against Misha Tate at UFC 200, her rear naked choke from the back, it looked like she was going to pop Misha Tate's head clean off her fucking shoulders.
Exactly, because of the aggression, the desire to win, isn't it?
But also, I don't think Tate displayed the same amount of grappling defense on the floor. And I also don't think she took the same amount of punishment on the feet, because Misha Tate was pretty much broken down at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
But all that regardless, Pena did enough to last out the round. But the second round was fucking mental. They just stood there punching each other in the face. Yeah, I think Juliana Pena's corner would have been dropping a few inshallahs in the fucking corner after that first round.
Yeah.
But the thing is, she did a really important thing both in the first round and the second round. When Nunes came forward to throw big bombs, and bear in mind, she's like the heaviest hitting female fighter in history, Pena met her with punches. She didn't slide away. She didn't put her head down. She didn't go slipping, sliding.
Fire with fire, innit?
She literally met her after the first phase. And even then, when Nunes recognised what she was doing, Nunes tried to go first and third. So even when she recognised what Pena was doing, she knew the counter was coming. So she'd try and throw a punch, wait for Pena to punch, and then she'd try and punch again. But the thing is, Pena was always there. To me, that mindset's incredible. To know that it's basically like fighting, I don't want to make a really lazy comparison, but it's like fighting Mike Tyson and not coming out of the pocket and staying there.
But then going back to my point is, like, I always feel like with UFC, is there more desire? You know, if she's going for the title, Pena, has she got more desire than maybe Nunes hasn't got the same desire to want to keep the belt as when they haven't obtained the belt, you know? Whereas you see people like Usman, who wants to win every fight he's in, and like Adesanya, you know, but from all the other weight divisions, you see numerous champions, because it's so unpredictable, and I don't know if they have the desire to want to retain the bout as much as they want to win the bout. You know what I mean?
I was listening to a weighing in podcast with John McCarthy, former UFC referee, and Josh Thompson, a former UFC title challenger, and they were saying like she's a mother, she's like a year out of the ring, and Pena might be a mother, but she's not a new mom, and all this kind of stuff. But I honestly have to go back to that first round, and I think Amanda Nunes looked really sharp. I think she looked really confident. I think her weight looked on point. I think she might have looked a bit tired towards the end because Juliana Pena forced grappling exchanges that she wasn't particularly expecting. But I didn't hear the final bell of the first round and thought, oh, this is going to Pena. In that second round, Pena, her jab, it wasn't the most educated jab.
It was scrappy a little bit.
It was
scrappy, but it was like a brawl, wasn't it?
But her timing was so good. Her technique might not have been on point, but she knew when to punch.
So it
was like this thing where she would take a shot, then go bang, bang. And then the finishing sequence, she hit her with about 4 jabs in the face.
It was bad, wasn't it?
Drove her back to the fence. And
she was exhausted when she got Nunes on the floor. Nunes was spent.
She was standing in the choke. What she should have been.
Well, think about the final takedown from Pena as well. That was some mad rolling type. Oh, I'm going to trip you and then roll you over the back. That shows you that Pena was present and Nunes wasn't.
And great call from the ref, because because that could have been messy for her, man. It's like he knew it was over for her straight away.
Well, she tapped.
She tapped, she did.
You know what I mean? But that's what I'm saying. He was straight down there with her, though.
I think everyone could see that Nunes was wilting. But even if you see Pena's finish, it wasn't the tidiest finish. She didn't have both hooks in. She just literally had one arm under the throat. And only just at the moment she was tapping, she got her left leg kind of over her hips. But it, as you say, both of you just said it. Like, she's exhausted. She took a few too many shots. But I was literally, I was scoring the fight. And India was going to me, "What are you shouting at?" And I'm going like, "Lock, lock!" And then she's stuck in the choke. And I was like, I was scoring the fight, and I threw down my paper pad. I was like, "This is fucking mental." Yeah. I did not see that happen at all, man, at all.
But one in the street fight, and she got it at the end of the day. That's how that was her game plan. I would assume Pena went into that fight. Her game plan from her team was: you need to make this a street fight. Make this as uncomfortable as you possibly can for Nunes. That's your way to victory.
Well, you know, I thought in the second round, Nunes, she fought an egotistical fight, similar to Michael Chandler against Gaethje.
Yeah,
similar to Charles Oliveira in the main event of the evening. At least in the first round, I think Oliveira. Yeah. He's a confident man. You know, he's like very tall, striding forward, high guard. I think he looked to pressure Dustin Poirier out of the fight, but Dustin Poirier's punches were fucking unreal, man.
Yeah, he's got such power, hasn't he, man?
But it was his combinations, man. Like, the way he was able to... He did, like, a little switch step to land his left hand, and then he brought in the right hook behind it. And it was this really explosive, head-rocking kind of movements. He dropped him with a right hook in the first round. But what Oliveira did before and after the knockdown is that he was able to grab the clinch, work these horrible knees to the body. Like, every time he hit those knees to the stomach, I felt my ribs like kind of, was like, even one of them.
Isn't it, man?
He's quite multifaceted though, isn't he, Oliveira? Which was the difference between like him and Poirier. And because obviously, I think you would say Poirier is like a striker, would you say?
Fundamentally, he's a puncher.
But he's also a black belt Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioner, Poirier. But he didn't look like it when he was up against Oliveira.
People like Oliveira, like you say, he's got so much style that it's like you don't know what he's going to do. It's so unpredictable.
But I'll say for his jiu-jitsu technique, Oliveira threatened a takedown in the very first round, probably 2 minutes in. Mm. And Oliveira was able to scramble out of that. Mm. He was able to get him off his back, retrieve a leg, stand back up.
Well. Yeah.
But that's when they're both dry and they're both
right.
Yeah, they're both alert and they're both fresh. By the time the second round came about, I mean, Dustin Poirier scored a right hook knockdown in the first. I think he dominated. Dominated is probably a bit strong, but I think he definitely was the winner in the striking exchanges in the first. The second round, it was just all-out domination, man. Like,
this is something I wanted to mention because I watched the match and a lot of the commentators, they don't mention this, and I think I was texting you about it. It was domination from Oliveira. But Poirier's defense in that second round was insane. He went on his back. Oliveira's on top of him for 3 straight minutes. Oliveira's holding him down, but Poirier was smart. He knew, if I'm going to try and scramble out of this, Oliveira's getting me in a Kimura. He's getting me in this. He's getting me that. He's going to take advantage. And as a BJJ black belt, he knew what to do was to grab him close. Yeah, to stop him doing anything dangerous. Now, what's amazing to me is he held him close for 3 whole minutes. And a few times, more than a few times, Oliveira slipped out and then dropped some disgusting elbows onto Poirier's face. It was hard to watch. And then he tried choking him and he had the hands on his face.
Hands on his face. Because
awful.
It's quite uncomfortable to watch when fighters.
It was very, very uncomfortable.
When they had the gloves on the eyes, it's a bit like, he's so close to eye gouging. It's so close to eye gouging.
But what I gotta say is Poirier to be able to handle that for 3 straight minutes until he got down on his back. I'm like, this is over. There's 3 minutes left. He ain't getting out of this. But he held it off for 3 minutes. Although he was dominated, he defended it amazingly. I'd probably liken it to that time Arnold Schwarzenegger. But yeah, that's the point I wanted to make. Yeah. I don't see many people mentioning it, but it was incredible that he could hold that after 3 minutes.
I agree with you, but the initial takedown is what I'm most interested in from Oliveira. The first one, Poirier dealt with it no problem. The second one, there were these phases to the takedown against the fence. So Oliveira, he got onto his back, grapevined onto his leg, the same way as he did in the first round. Poirier managed to shrug him off, but Oliveira, when he went down, he managed to keep hold of his arm, threatened a triangle straight away.
Yeah.
Right. So Poirier's thinking, fuck this, I need to get out of here.
He slipped out of that.
Yeah. Oliveira threatened an omoplata straight away, which is like a reverse kind of shoulder lock. Right.
Right.
And then when Poirier rolled out of that, that's how they ended up in that top position. So they're edging in, like Oliveira's steadily imposing himself in the grappling exchanges.
Poirier's playing checkers, Oliveira's playing chess.
Exactly, yeah. So I agree with you that he did his best to kind of reduce the potential cost to him in the second round. But I also think that Oliveira found a lot of heavy shots with close elbows, with punches, to the point where, like, I was thinking, I've never seen someone find hard shots from that that tight a distance. It was horrible, man. He was bouncing his head off the canvas with those. So by the time the second round ended and the third round started, he started the exact same grappling exchange again. And Poirier just had nothing for him. He just latched onto him. And that long squeeze, Poirier was still on his feet when he tapped. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just levels. And I like the way that Oliveira abandoned potentially an egotistical approach, which is what I think Nunes did. And he played to his strengths and he showed his durability. And he showed a multifaceted game.
Exactly like Naomi Yunus. That's what she went back to doing that, you know, and she got rid of her, like,
Zhang Weili.
She got rid of her, like, ego about it, you know. She was like,
yeah,
they get too big for it, don't they? Yeah. They start thinking that they're untouchable. Yeah. Probably what Nunes was thinking herself.
I think there was
definitely a first total defense, though.
Definitely an element of that.
Yeah. I've read something that I found quite, I found it was quite interesting. There was this geezer, Charles Sonnen. I don't know if you've heard of him.
No. Oh, I've seen this.
He's a former 3-time UFC title challenger for nearly beating Anderson Silva before he got tapped out in the fourth round, fought John Jones, fought Anderson Silva again. He's a G. His record's like dog shit at the minute.
Incredible,
like,
geezer, though.
Incredible guy.
Yeah, but I only see him on YouTube giving these fucking weird takes. Like, yeah, that's how I know him. I didn't know he was an ex-fighter. He just seems like
he's a gentleman. On his day, yeah, probably like 2013, 2014, he was like an actual sick fighter, man.
Okay. More respect for him.
I thought this was quite a weird... quite a weird take from him. Like, he intimated that, like, Khabib's legacy had been tainted by this Charles Oliveira win. So I think he was thinking that essentially, because Khabib wiped the floor with, like, all the competition in his last three fights with McGregor, Poirier and Justin Gaethje. Yeah. Like, there might be a significant fight that was missing. Obviously, Khabib is roughly the same age, isn't he? Is he 32?
Yeah, but is he suggesting that he didn't fight Oliveira, so...
He was, like, kind of sidestepping him?
Oliveira weren't shit on anyone's radar until he beat, what's his name? The Detroit City fucking superstar that... But literally, he beat him, and then Oliveira beat Tony Ferguson after that. That's how he got his total shot against Michael Chandler for the vacant belt.
Yeah.
And then that's how I don't think Oliveira was a credible lightweight challenger, because he moved up from featherweight just before
that. It's a very crazy division, isn't it? Like,
Yeah. The lightweight killers.
I think of all divisions, it's the one that, like, they keep fighting. The same guys keep fighting for titles, don't they? It's like everyone keeps overtaking, and, you know, it's such an interesting division.
You know, if McGregor rolls back in there, he gets one good win.
What are you saying?
No.
But apparently he's saying that his rightful next fight is Oliveira. But
which is outrageous, because you've got, like,
I think apparently Dana's brushed it aside, doesn't he?
So only geezer he's won in the last 5 years is Donald Cerrone. Cowboy Cerrone, isn't it? Yeah. That's the only geezer he's beaten in the last 5 years. And obviously, he lost to Poirier twice. Yeah.
But they're saying Gaethje, aren't they, next for Oliveira?
Dana said Gaethje's going to be next. He's not fully confirmed it, but at the post-fight press conference, they said, is Gaethje next? And he went, yeah, it's got to be Gaethje.
But they brushed off with McGregor's.
Fair that McGregor fights Makhachev or Danush.
Makhachev will Makhachev
smoke McGregor.
Yeah.
I mean, so you can't say, I want the chat to the titles if, like, you can't even beat any of the eight contenders.
Yeah.
My favourite fighters coming through is, what's he called, Chinkadze, is that his name?
Georgian.
I haven't seen much of him.
He's brutal, man. They're a different breed, aren't they, when they're from that.
I'm telling you.
Them caucus lads.
Yeah, but I'm saying, even Islam Makhachev and Benil Dariush, you're meant to be fighting, aren't they?
Yeah.
You're only Feb. Dariush should batter McGregor. Straight up, man. I'm telling you. But the thing is, if you're the UFC...
Tony Ferguson didn't the last time out.
And if you're Dana White, you can't ignore the money that McGregor brings to the table.
That's the only reason he'll get the fight, isn't it? Because everyone will want to watch
him. If he gets one more big win, that's it. He's back into the top picture.
He is.
So, Jim, give us a roundup of what else happened in the UFC. We haven't even started on the boxing yet.
Okay, we'll just quickly run it through. Cody Garbrandt got absolutely murked in his
round one. What's wrong with that geezer?
And, you know what, listen, he won the title in 2016 against Dominic Cruz in a masterful performance. Like, Dominic Cruz was this puzzle for the bantamweight for years and years. Battered everyone, beat TJ Dillashaw.
Was it too late for Cruz in that fight? That was the thing.
It might have been a bit too late.
Mm.
But he still beat a guy who was a long-standing champion and who had this way of fighting that everyone found perplexing.
And his record as well. Yeah, it was a great record.
And he absolutely scored him. Since then, I think in his last six fights, he's got one win. Do you know what I mean? And I think he tried to move down to flyweight as like a way to reinvent himself. And he just got smashed a bit. Kai Kara France just walked him down and banged him out. Three knockdowns. Done and dusted. I don't know where he goes from here, to be honest.
And he was the favourite for that fight as well, I believe.
And well, yeah, because he dropped a division. He was he's probably trying to be a bit of a weight bully.
Yeah,
he tried it out and got fucked up. But that's the chance that you take, though, when you try to drop a division. You can either be a weight bully or you can lose your chin. And it looks like the latter happened.
Never had the best chin anyway. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I feel for the real UFC fans that, like you said, McGregor comes back. I don't think many people are that interested. It's just the outside viewers.
I am.
No, but...
I am. Yeah. I love him. I know what he's done. Horrible shit outside the ring. Outside
probably
the
best legs of Robbie Dunne. Any the jockey.
he probably is. He's obviously a bit of a scumbag, man. But come on.
I feel like as a UFC fan, I'd rather see many more matchups than McGregor fighting anyone that's out for title shot.
I would say so myself. But yeah, sticking with the bantamweight division. Obviously, we've just mentioned Dominic Cruz. Just about got his bantamweight win, like one of his first in three or four fights. He got knocked down in the first round against Pedro Munhoz, but he managed to get it. I'm not sure if he deserved that decision for me. But also in the bantamweight scene, Sean O'Malley, he knocked out this kid called Rolian Paver.
Is that round one as well?
I think it was, you know. But you know what, listen, I think...
First round.
I think it's the same old story with O'Malley. I like his striking style. I think he's flamboyant. I think he's got a good measure of distance and I think he's got a good left hand. But at the same time, I think he's knocking over kids that he should be knocking over. And he doesn't want the Chito Vera rematch. Is the UFC don't want that rematch.
Is he under the Dana White Protection Act?
So. I think what a perfect way to put it, man.
Yeah, that is spot on.
Exactly.
The man, Flynn, before you object, right? The man's walking around with a hoodie saying 13-0.
I'm a big fan of the Sugar Show. I think he's wicked, man. I think he's wicked, and it's not 13-0, it's 15-0, I think he's got. But he did a good interview with Steve-O. You remember Steve-O from Jackass?
Oh, no, Perish of Thought.
He's got his own podcast, and he interviewed Sugar Sean just the day before the match. He explained his reasons why he doesn't recognise the loss against Chito. But anyway, he said he's offered him out for a rematch, but it's Chito saying to him, that would be a step back for me to rematch you. And he's like, well, you made more money than you're ever going to make fighting me, so it wouldn't be a step back. But anyway, I love him.
Point on both sides, to be honest with you.
Did you hear his reasons for denying he was beat by Chito?
He had an ankle injury or a calf injury or something like that.
No, he just said there was an injury and at some point he got a leg kick and he felt Chito's toe hit the back of his knee and it made his leg go a bit numb.
Yeah.
He fell down and Chito landed one elbow in his face and the ref finished it. And he said, I was completely lucid, whatever. But, you know, the ref's decision, I'm a company man, ref's decision for me. But he's asked him for a rematch. Chito said no, but I'm a huge fan.
He got finished to me legitimately. Like,
yeah.
I was just going to move swiftly on to the boxing because I'm conscious of time. From one company man to another, Conor Benn, he scored a fourth round KO and it was a proper KO of Chris Algieri. And I am hesitant to hark back to last week yet again because I said if Conor Benn wins with an early stoppage, I'll be on the hype train. And I'm
on the hype train, you know.
I'm going to welch, you know. I'm going to welch on that statement completely because even though I think Chris Algieri, I stand by everything I said about him last week. I think he's a big unit, moved well. And I think he was catching Ben with a lot of shots coming in, especially with the left hook. I think Ben, for his part, he has a problem closing the distance and that's his only problem, really. I think he's a natural body puncher. I think he's aggressive. I think he's durable. And I think he wants to win. I think he wants to put on a show. I was very impressed by him in this fight. But I think a higher level operator will catch him in that middle distance, because he you can see him coming in. You can see him coming into that distance, man.
Well, he's under the Eddie Hearn Protection Act as well, isn't he? Because they won't put him in against a heavy hitter because they don't want him to get a tarnished record at the start.
That was a good matchup, though, for him, wasn't it?
I think that was a statement finish, wasn't it?
Was it three losses?
The only person that finished him before was Errol Spence, and his other two losses were to Manny Pacquiao, knocked him down about 5 or 6 times, and then Amir Khan, who done him on decision. So I stand by my statement from last week that an early finish or a finish at all would impress me.
He just seems like an impressive guy, to be honest, because I've heard him talk as well, and he carries himself well.
He's well up
he's
for it,
man. He's a bit cocky, but he's not overly cocky, is he? And he seems like he's up for learning, isn't he? So
he's well up for it.
Extremely young, man.
Hopefully he doesn't go down the Joshua line, to be honest.
The thing is, man, like, again, I can't say I'm on the hype train fully, because I think he's got improvements to make. Like, the hype train to me means he'll batter anyone right now. I don't feel that way about him, but every time I see him fight, he makes massive improvements. And I think he's probably 2-3 fights away from being like a serious world contender. Mm. He says he's top 5 in the world right now. A lot of people from the podcast I listen to disagree with that. I'm not sure he's that far away from being a top 5 welterweight contender. I don't think he is, to be honest with you.
One of the reasons he lists for himself, you know, the way that he's stuck to all his opponents and whatever, and the way that he's, like, beat up some of his opponents.
We got to think about who he's fought. Again, I won't piss on the Algerian matchup, because I do think that was legit. Sammy Vargas, I think that was legit as well. Granados, I think that was a legit matchup. His last 3 fights have been absolutely solid for me. I think before that, his resume is really, really light. And again, he doesn't strike me as the type of kid who shies away from adversity either.
No.
So I think he's going to go from strength to strength.
I feel like he's been progressing really well.
Yeah, so what does continental welterweight mean? Because I heard that earlier and I wasn't sure what it meant.
It's like he's going for the WBA ranking belt system. So I think what a lot of boxing fans, or hardcore quote-unquote boxing fans, don't like about him is that he bypassed the traditional route of Commonwealth, British, European, that kind of stuff. But that doesn't necessitate that you're going to be a better fighter than anyone else.
So is he just welterweight? That's what he is.
Yeah, he's a welterweight. And, you know, with Errol Spence Jr. being out almost indefinitely with the torn retina, Terence Crawford, I don't know what he's going to do after just beating up Sean Porter.
To you, though, you're a boxing aficionado, you know what I mean? But to me, when I see these, like, middleweight fights, then they don't give me as much draw as they would as, like, a Tyson Fury fight, because that's just like a natural thing, isn't it, for, say, someone that's not... I like boxing, but it might be a personality thing,
do you know what I mean? Same reason why
Flynn probably likes Sean McGregor and O'Malley, you know, because...
But, yeah, Conor Benn's got a great personality to drag people into the sport. He rubs me the wrong way sometimes, but that's not a massive deal for me. Like, I want to watch him do that and get better. But on the same card, Katie Taylor, she defended all of her lightweight belts. She's got back 6 of them against Firouza Sharapova by 10-round decision. The rounds were close, but I thought Taylor edged them with extra flurries here and there. It wasn't the most exciting affair. And bafflingly, going back to the Hamza Shiraz thing from earlier, Sharapova was deducted a point in the 6th round for hitting out with a little shot on the break. And this was, like, literally a little backhand flick. And that's the same penalty that Shiraz suffered for landing a 3-punch combo with Bradley Skeet on his ass. So you tell me, mate.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Consistency, isn't it? It's the same as, like, what we went back to with the football chat. Yeah, exactly. The VAR, there's no consistency in these decisions, which seems to be the general rule in all sports anyway, doesn't it? That there's no...
Well, you know, I'll say there's one difference between, from my perspective, between football and boxing, is that the hometown fighter... The hometown fighter in boxing gets massively away, man.
Yeah.
It's fucking unreal, man. I'm all for, like, people making money and, like, you know, I get the whole system. But I think there's limits, man. But don't do it so blatantly, do you know what I mean? I think those differences were, but especially, like, 2 weeks apart, do you know what I mean?
Just a quick one, Taylor, just because I want to keep this moving on, because we've still got a lot to talk about on the boxing. But obviously, she started her sort of professional career quite late, but in 2016. She'd been through the sort of Olympic setup. She'd won golds, you know, in European competitions and Commonwealth competitions, whatever. And then she's, what, 35 now. So she's up against somebody that started in the same year, 2016, but was about 8 years younger than her.
First of all, is that indicative of the way women's boxing's improved and the sort of the attention that it's getting? And also, what does she do next? Because she's basically cleaning out everything that's within her realm. There is a fighter that they've put
Amanda Serrano
yeah. that they've put up against her, potentially.
Well, she just beat Celia Brocos, who was undefeated for like 10 years or something before that. And there's another one, Chantel Cameron, who's WBA, something or other. She's British.
That's Serrano. She's held belts in about six different... No, I think it might have been eight different weight divisions as well.
But it speaks to the burgeoning nature of the women's scene in boxing, doesn't it? And I think Katie Taylor... I don't know where the women's boxing scene is going to go, but you have to acknowledge the forerunners. And Katie Taylor is one of those. And Clarissa Shield is one of those.
She has been as well for years.
I think, you know, she even if the sport goes nowhere, she's always going to be one of the foundational points of that sport.
But Clarissa Shields, what she did, she's still only, what, 26?
Yeah.
She moved over to UFC,
the PFL.
To gain, I would assume, because there's more money there. That's, why would you do it?
Well, it depends, man. I think, I don't like the way Clarissa Shield talks and the way she goes on. I like her attitude in terms of the fight she's willing to take. And it's similar to Conor Benn, really. Do you know what I mean? I don't think these fighters rub me the wrong way a lot of the time, but you can't diss them in terms of their willingness to fight, man. You really can't.
And I think, half the time it's not even down to them, is it? You know, it's down to, well, not even half the time. Most of the time it's down to whoever wants to make them fight whoever, you know.
Exactly, man. But yeah, it was, again, you've alluded to, so we'll run through the results from last weekend. Sonny Edwards kept his flyweight title against Jason Mama. Dmitry Bivol, he outclassed his challenger, Umar Salimov. I was talking shit about Bivol last week because I thought it was boring, but his defence is unreal, man. I was watching it late on Saturday night and I was like, thinking, say if you had a son who you was going to teach how to box, this is how you teach him how to box.
Basically Mayweather.
It's not Mayweather levels. He doesn't have these big, showy defensive movements, but he knows how to keep himself safe. His jab's on point. His feet are on point. Yeah, it was just a masterful performance, really. It wasn't the most exciting thing. Like, you could have set your watch to it, 12-round decision, 118, 110, or whatever. Like, literally, you could. It's predictable. It's not exciting. But at times, it's quite beautiful, really.
Yeah.
The one thing I did get gassed about was Nonito Donaire, who dispatched undefeated Raymar Ganeo in the fourth round with a wicked left hook to the body. Caballo started well, showed a good straight punches, but Donaire was so sharp, man. He was picking right hands over the left-hand jab, and he built his aggression from the early rounds. And you see this in early Donaire fights where he starts doing this little jinking rhythm, left, right, and then he explodes. And he had like a really kind of condensed version, a little bit of a more subtle version of that in this fight. And then when the finish came in the fourth round, it was literally a left hand right up into the rib cage. Caballo didn't even see it coming, man. And that he looked in shock. He went down to his right knee, and he tried to get up at nine, and he just couldn't. And
their body shots are brutal, aren't they?
And like, Nonito Donaire, again, I didn't check on Boxrec. This is what everyone's saying, and I know part of this is true. He's a five-weight world champion across three decades. And he's an all-time great. I've spoke about him for time, man. He's fucking sick. He doesn't even train with someone. He trains himself. His wife's his manager. He's just navigating through the situation on his own.
Who does he spar? His wife.
Yeah. No, he goes to spar, but like...
Street fights.
Yeah.
Spar's the ghost.
This is Archie Moore status, man, for the old school boxing fans, and God bless him. Like, long may it continue, you know what I mean? But finally, I nearly forgot this when I was writing it, Vasyl Lomachenko dispatched Richard Comey over 12-round decision. He should have knocked him out in the seventh. I don't know how Comey got up from that. Lomachenko even compelled the opposition corner to finish him. He's like, listen, pull him out of here now. Pull him out of here. Comey's corner were like, nah. And Lomachenko shrugged his shoulders and started beating the shit out of him.
Go on, then. You're going to finish it. I'll finish it.
That's what you're doing. I gave you the chance. Yeah. But, you know, this is after one of the rounds as well, Lomachenko showed him back to his corner. And there's been a talk amongst the...
Was it disrespect or was it...
showmanship.
Where was it on the line? Yeah, I was thinking that when I was watching.
I think he was being a cunt, to be honest with
you. Yeah, because when he first dropped it and he got back up, I thought it was a little bit disrespectful. But then the second time when Kami was like buckling on his knees and he just about held himself up on the ropes, I was thinking, and then I think there was a flurry about 30 seconds after that where Lomachenko was just finding angles like he'd been doing all night, just like almost like dancing around him. I made the reference to, like, you know, when Yoshimitsu does that move and like it goes invisible and then just pops up next to you. That's why it looked like Lomachenko was doing to Kami. I was thinking, how is the referee not calling this?
I think the referee...
With 30 seconds left, I was like,
I think the referee should have stopped it in the seventh round.
Yeah, I was like, mate, he's already been knocked down once. He was wobbling on the ropes. And now there's a lot of punches landing in this little flurry. I feel like I was surprised.
The thing is, seconds before that left hand landed, Lomachenko missed a really vicious right hook by millimetres. And then the knockdown was one of the shortest, crispest left hands I've ever seen. It looked like there was nothing behind it. Bang. Like, literally touched him on the jaw and he fell down like he'd been fucking slapped with a pile of bricks, man. It was... it was some Bruce Lee shit. I want the Lomachenko Kambosos Jr. fight next.
It's gotta be, isn't it?
I want that, man.
Love Kambosos Jr. He's amazing.
What a legend. Listen to that Joe Rogan interview.
I saw it.
Fantastic. Wicked, man.
He trained with Pacquiao for what? How many rounds did he? 200 rounds.
He did with him, man. So
amazing.
Sick, man.
Amazing interview.
George Kambosos Jr., just a little shout out to him. He's a fucking G, man. He's like, yeah, he hit me with a good shot, mate. He didn't know fighters like me, mate. I'm hitting bit agitated, mate. We're fighting around the world.
A gentleman, though, he come across like...
Tim Zaitsev Jr. as well.
He's sick, Tim.
I've seen the rise of him, you know, because this guy, basically, that we met in Australia, some like security guys, somehow... was like the original Saizu. Is that how you say it? Saizu?
Sue.
So he was the original guy that looked after his dad.
I've got
him on Facebook. So I've seen the rise of this like kid from his like, first fight.
Amazing.
And it's sick, man, because he's unbeaten. And it's 20, no, his dad is, you know?
Yeah. So Kostyuzu was the guy that Ricky Hatton beat with his first world title fight in Manchester. One of the highest regarded fucking championship fights in British history.
And now his little brother's in as well. They brought his little brother.
Oh, so sick. But Tim too looked fucking wicked, man. Yeah, the Aussies are absolutely smashing.
I never knew how to say the name. It's mad. It's like T-S-Y-Z.
They're like half Russian, half Australian.
I mean, they're Greek Australians, I think, yeah. Kambasa's family.
Anyone who's halfway interested in listening to that Joe Rogan episode,
Joe Rogan every week. He's coming back. We had to get a few months off, but now he's starting to speak to
Joe Rogan. I remember, praise be Joe Rogan.
Joe Rogan, man.
Yeah. The funny thing is, you watch one of his videos on YouTube and you get fucking weightlifting adverts in your internet for weeks afterwards. Hey, do you want to be super buff?
We're going to this weekend then. Artur Beterbiev, this is the guy who a lot of people think Canelo bypassed on his way to cruiserweight. He's fighting Marcus Brown, and I think he'll beat the ever-loving shit out of him, man. Artur Beterbiev, he stopped Callum Johnson. He's beat Gvozdik. He's literally 16 fights, 16 KOs, similar to Lomachenko, long amateur career. Devastating fighter. Absolutely devastating. I don't fancy Marcus Brown's chances in this. Saturday night, Derek Chisora, Joseph Parker, they've got their rematch. I can't remember anything about their fight. I couldn't even remember the result. When I was thinking, I didn't even know it happened.
It was a bit of a non-event, wasn't it? Obviously, fucking Parker won.
Parker got the split decision. I don't think it was a very good fight, and I don't know why they're having the rematch, to be honest with you.
It's not interesting to anyone, is it?
Like, not even for me, man. And I want it.
Is it pay-per-view as well?
No, I think it's straight on the zone. But to be honest with you, I thought Joseph Parker, he lost to Joshua, which is, you know, fair enough. Josh was a brilliant fighter, as far as I'm concerned. But after that, it's just like he's been on this massive slide. I thought he should have lost to Junior Farr, this random New Zealand
guy. Yeah.
I think he should have lost to Huey Fury when he had his title. I think he was hard done by against Dillian White because basically a headbutt was the deciding factor in that fight. So it's not as if he's like a nothing fighter, but I don't know what his ambitions are. Like, Derek Chisora is just going to exist in the heavyweight division,
he's
as long as he can.
So. He's, you know, you say fair play to Del Boy, and at least he's putting himself out there and he wants more fights. He wants to earn a bit more money. Yeah. But in terms of he's respecting that division, he just, you know, he's, yeah. he, it's hard to say.
You want Fantin to be at the top, boys, but that's no disrespect to him, innit? Do you know what I mean? So, yeah. But again, Lewis Ritson's back on the Saturday. He's fighting some random Mexican, Christian Urezquieta. You can help me out here, Flynn.
If you spelled it correctly, it would be Urezquieta.
Urezquieta. Holla.
Get a language expert in.
But yeah, UFC's back as well. Derek Lewis against Chris Daukas. Yeah, again, Bilal Muhammad back against, what's his name? Steven. Oh, that'd be a good fight against Steven Thompson.
I like Bilal Muhammad. Yeah, I've rated him whenever I've watched him.
When he cried his eyes out against Leon Edwards. Remember that? and Angela Hill against Amanda Lemos. Cub Swanson against Darren Elkins is the one I'm looking for. Cub Swanson has victories over Charles Oliveira, Dustin Poirier, and recently battered Cron Gracie. So that's coming up. No one's ever going to remember this guy's name, Cub Swanson. It's not part of the Twitterverse. It's not part of the big firework display. But he's got wins over the fucking men in the division right now.
Did Cerrone beat Oliveira as well? He's lost some weird games.
No, it's fucking weird.
He's gone on some mad like win streak now, and he had a lot of like really kind of weird losses early on in his career, but now he's like put on this mad like run of form.
The fight game is impossible to predict, man.
Yep. That's how you become great. You could lose some shit at the beginning, but then you're gonna hit that streak like Makhachev at the moment.
It's different to it's game.
But that's the beauty of UFC, isn't it? That you're never going to be able to match someone's fighting style. Like, you don't know what it's so unpredictable, isn't it? You know, like, you can
see
boxing videos and you know what they're going to do, but then if someone that you like comes out and just starts doing stuff that you're not expecting, like,
there's more options in the UFC, MMA. Do you know what I mean? It's so unpredictable.
Like, when McGregor was dropping them out, the shoulders, man, like, who would have predicted that was going to happen? Like, you know, he's going to just start, like,
and now that's a pretty common thing to see in fights now.
I've seen a few fighters do that since, man.
Yeah.
But again,
developed a technique in a way.
That was an extended combat sports section. Thank you all for your patience.
Extended.
But, loved it.
Extended podcast.
Loved it.
Any podcast.
That's really. It was the best one yet. The best combat sports section yet.
Right? Any episode's the best one yet, as always.
Easy.
Combat sports.
I was sick having you on, though, man, because your sport knowledge is crazy. Yeah. It really is. When are you going to start your own podcast up?
I ain't got time to do that, man. I'll just be a regular guest for you.
Yes, and that makes it. Because we don't need competition right now.
I need an excuse to get out of the house anyway. Man, if I tell them I'm part of something,
have you got any shows to pick up that are coming up soon?
23rd of December in Moseley. So that's next Thursday, 2 days before Christmas.
That's the one we're going to, isn't it?
Yeah, you bought tickets.
I'm booked in, mate.
So you must be booked in.
You'll be there, Flynn. You'll be there.
Yeah, Pizzy messaged me the other day asking me to come. So yeah, fuck it. I'll be in Birmingham. I'll come.
Pizzy bought tickets. He said that you bought tickets. Well, he gave you money, and then you said that you're not giving him a ticket.
He's talking absolutely.
He said he paid for that.
No, the glazing business is off the chain right now, man. He can afford to lose that, though, man.
I heard a joke. One last little sporting thing. I heard a joke thing on TalkSport earlier about Johnny Clayton, because the darts is starting this week. He's like ranked number 8 in the world or whatever. He is a plasterer. Doesn't practice darts at all. He doesn't want to miss work because he loves the banter, and he just goes. And he's won 4 majors this year.
But
Phil Taylor apparently has practice all day, every day. Like,
and that is fucking.
He's going to miss the banter, but he's winning tournaments daily. Like, and he could win the championship. 4 majors.
Johnny Clayton.
Big up Johnny Clayton.
Let's get him on a t-shirt. He should be the first t-shirt. That is my attitude towards everything. That's mad.
Yeah, just doesn't want to miss the bank, so he's just
that was well worth it, man.
Gerwyn Jones?
Gerwyn Price.
That's it. Used to be a rugby player, and then he.
Well, apparently he's opened his own cafe in South Wales, and he's cooking up the food in there.
Fucking multi-talented geezers, man.
We don't cover the darts.
Eight years ago, he wasn't even a professional, and now he's a PDC world champion.
Well.
I'm going to go back home and start throwing some darts.
I think we can all agree that Stitch's sport knowledge is absolutely on point, and you've
both got the scale.
Stats, man. As well. And I've never been invited to these darts tournaments, man, because I used to play at my dad's all the time, but I haven't played properly in about 2 years. And
we'll have to get some Christmas darts.
I love a game of darts, man. Genuinely, man. I'm all right after, like, if you give me two 301s to warm up, I'm all right.
Me and Pizzy are going to go to Riley's one day if the lads are up for it anyway. So.
Let's see.
Let's organise them as fit.
Paul and darts.
Well, we'll stop boring our 15 listeners right now and we'll sign off right there, man.
You've only got 14 this week because I'm here.
You bastard. Thank you very much.
No worries. That's been a pleasure.
Cheers, Flint, Stitch. That was awesome.
Flint, thank you, man. I know you've been basically...
Statsman Flint.
You've had a tough time of it this week, man. Come back to the UK, extra tests, all that. I look forward to seeing you in person. If we can, next Tuesday, we're gonna get into the studio. All right.
100%. Can't wait for it.
I've got to go and let my pregnant missus in as well, so...
Check out Young Culture, mate.
Check out Young Culture.
What else can you check out on SoundCloud or
Bandcamp is where we sell
Spotify as well.
So if you search like Young Culture Bandcamp, we've got like merch and you can buy our songs on there and stuff. It goes more directly to us than it does like if you buy it on or like listen to it.
So Bandcamp, perfect place to buy their music, man. And big up Richie Blake as well.
Yeah, Richie Culture.
Hone it down.
Big up.
That's it for this week.